House Committee on Education will come to order. It is, what day is today?
24th.
It's the 24th of May, 2010. It's 8 in the morning. For those in the audience, if you have a cell phone with you or a pager, please turn it not just to silent, but all the way off. It interferes with the sound system and the recording devices, and we want to make sure that everyone is able to enjoy this very interesting hearing today. For members of the committee, welcome back. It's good to see all of you here today. I sent you an email last night giving you a sense of our timelines for today. We have a very full agenda with topics that, knowing each of you, I'm sure will generate a lot of conversations and discussion. And I sent you ahead of time the time in which I'm trying to contain each of those discussions so that you can help me keep things moving along on the agenda. We're going to start out today, and there is a slight change in the order of what is on the agenda. We're going to start with seclusion and restraint, and we'll then be moving on to the role of athletics in the university system as our second item, and then popping back and staying in order. We're starting today with a discussion about policies related to seclusion and restraint of students in Oregon schools. And we have an interesting panel of people that are going to speak to us today. This is an issue that really has to do with behavior management and the safety of both students and staff. The U.S. House of Representatives just in March passed legislation, which is now sitting in the Senate, that would address this issue on a national level. And you also have now in front of you, I believe, a letter from U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan that he sent last year urging states to start to address these issues in order to ensure student and staff safety. So we have today a variety of people. We're going to hear from Sharon Lewis, who was the lead staff person on this issue for the U.S. House Committee. She's now moved on to another role, and she's the new commissioner for the Federal Administration on Developmental Disabilities, but is not testifying on behalf of the administration today, and she will tell you more about that. We're going to hear from Mr. Edwards from Oregon School Employees Association, and we're also going to hear from Disability Rights Oregon. This is a discussion that we will continue to have over the next several months. The Department of Ed is in the room, but I have not invited them to the panel today. We will hear from them next time. And with that, I would turn it over to Commissioner Lewis. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to join you today. And I do need to make clear from the can you guys hear me okay? I'm getting a little bit of feedback.
Yes.
Okay. I do need to make clear from the outset at this point that I am participating here today as an individual with some expertise based on my experience as the Senior Disability Policy Advisor to the Chairman of the Committee on Education and Labor, and not in my role with the administration, as Sarah mentioned, and additionally, certainly not representing Chairman Miller at this point, but basically talking about it from a historical perspective from my time there on the Hill. So I thought I would just start off with a little bit of background on why we took this issue on at the federal level, and the progression to the point of passing the House legislation, which we are hopeful that the Senate will take up soon.
Commissioner Lewis, I apologize. I failed to have you identify yourself for the record. Could you do that, please?
Oh, I am
Thank
so
you.
Sorry. This is Sharon Lewis, currently a resident of Falls Church, Virginia.
Thank you.
So in any case, the issue of seclusion and restraint in the schools was actually an issue that was first brought to my attention when I was working on the other side of the Capitol in Senator Dodd's office. It was an issue that the senator was very concerned about, having addressed the issue in health care and in Medicaid and mental health facilities through an amendment to the Public Health Act in the year 2000, the Children's Health Act of 2000, that created limitations on the use of seclusion and restraint, including limitations in residential community facilities. And as he put it at that point, we thought we had put this issue to bed, but the stories from states continued to come forward over time. And when I moved over to the House of Representatives in 2007, at that point, the committee was looking at abuses and deaths, frankly, of children in residential facilities that were private entities trying to handle behavioral issues through wilderness camps and those types of therapeutic boarding schools. So this was an issue that was of interest to the chairman from the outset, from that perspective, and we had had the GAO take a look at those the issues in those residential entities, and then the story started to come in about public school children. And to be honest, members of Congress were shocked and dismayed that we had stories coming in of students being restrained for hours at a time, hundreds of times over the course of a few days, students being locked into small, inappropriate spaces, and things that folks didn't think could actually be happening in our public schools. So we requested another GAO study specifically looking at this issue in the schools. And because of the lack of consistent data, chose to look at it through the lens of several case studies, as well as asking the GAO to do a broad analysis of state policies and provide us information back on what was the landscape as it related to seclusion and restraint. That request was made in January of 2009, on the heels of a national report that the National Disability Rights Network, and I know DRO is going to talk a little bit about that background, but protection and advocacy agencies all across the country had built their own report around what was happening in the schools, and there's a lot of variation in how states were then managing these issues. Moving forward, we had a hearing in May of 2009 looking at that GAO report and hearing from witnesses on what was happening and what some of the potential solutions were and where there were states that were engaging on protecting both the students and staff and keeping everyone safe. Out of that information, we then engaged in a bipartisan conversation with the chairman as well as Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers from just up north, around what were some of the issues and talking to stakeholders from the education community, the disability rights community, families, and some of the advocates that had been working on these issues for years, as well as having an extensive conversation with experts in the mental health field who are ahead of the curve in many places in looking at how do you reduce and eliminate the need for seclusion and restraint, which I think across all of the various stakeholders we were talking to was the end goal. There was an acknowledgement that seclusion and restraint unto themselves are behavior management techniques that are often implemented due to lack of other alternatives, not in the first line of behavior management. And so we started to try and identify what those issues were in terms of why were folks getting to this point and what were the common areas of concern. And it really came down to several elements. First and foremost, we had a pretty crazy patchwork quilt of regulation in this area. We have some states that have picked up this issue and run with it and seen it as something that is important to monitor data on, to ensure that staff have training up on, to ensure that there are clear definitions and an understanding of when it is appropriate to use seclusion and restraint and when it is not. And then we have other places that have not looked at the issue at all. I think that from our perspective at the federal level, and certainly Chairman Miller said this repeatedly, you know, we would like to see states take the lead on this, and the federal legislation is constructed as such. It lays down a set of principles and requirements that states then have 2 years to adopt should the legislation pass, and demonstrate to the federal government that students are protected and that data is being collected in order to ensure appropriate implementation. What the legislation at the federal level does broadly is it really establishes minimum safety standards, not unlike some of what I think you have intended in your regulations at the state level there in Oregon, which is really looking at physical restraint and lock seclusion only when there is an imminent danger of injury. And I think the other important component of what we looked at the federal level is that staff should not be implementing physical restraint or seclusion without being trained. Most of the incidents that we saw that the GA looked at were individuals, whether they be the students themselves or staff, were being injured, was often due to a lack of protocol and training within the school. The federal legislation also prohibited specific techniques, including use of mechanical restraint, use of chemical restraint, use of any restraint that restricts breathing, prohibition on aversive behavioral interventions that compromise health and safety, for example, denying water or food or access to toilet facilities. And then requirements around notifying parents or guardians when restraint or seclusion had been used. It's a very broad set of minimal guidelines, and again, Chairman Miller saw that as a minimum level of standards that he would hope that states would take up and build upon, that also ensured that the focus in behavior management moves towards positive behavior supports as opposed to a reactive approach of behavior management. And so in moving forward in this process, we had that baseline understanding in terms of a core value around not wanting to outright ban seclusion or restraint, but get to a place where it was really understood to be an emergency intervention. And in having that as the core tenet in building the set of standards and really honing in on those minimum requirements, we were able to hang on to bipartisan support. Educators stood with us. We ended up passing legislation in the House of Representatives with over 100 supporting organizations signed on to the bill, including folks like the American Federation of Teachers, the School Boards Association, private special education centers, and as well as many community and disability groups across the country. So that is a quick synopsis of where we went with the legislation. A couple of other key points that I just wanted to circle back on. We made a very specific decision at the federal level to make this, as we called it, an all-kids bill, not a special education bill. The data does demonstrate that the majority of the incidents of seclusion and restraint do involve students who are students with disabilities either under IDEA or under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. However, not all of the kids who are being secluded and restrained fell into those categories. We also felt that from a federal policy level, this is a basic health and safety issue, and that it did not make sense to set up two sets of standards for different groups of kids. So that was the decision, was to tie this into federal education resources as it impacts all kids, not just students with disabilities. The other thing that we found that was very interesting in all of this, and the federal legislation reaches down into early childhood, including Head Start and pre-K programs and preschool programs that are receiving federal funds, was that the preliminary data, and again, some of it is anecdotal because we don't have a good national resource clearinghouse on this data, but the data that we were able to pull showed that many of the students who were being affected were children under the age of 11, which surprised many of us. We would have, common sense, thought that this would be an issue that would be affecting older students and youth, but it really, what we've shown is when we have states that are collecting data, as well as data that was collected from some of the national organizations, is that often it is the younger children who are being restrained, and this is consistent with what we've seen in studies in the mental health field. So I think that's another important element as we're talking about all of this. The children that are being affected are often at the early childhood, elementary and middle school level, not just at the high school level. The last point I'd like to make in all of this is that, when we looked at states across the country, there are very few states who have addressed this comprehensively, who are doing the data collection that's necessary, who are ensuring that there are training protocol and resources available for staff, who are ensuring that systems of positive behavior supports are available, which I know Oregon is a leader on that front, and looking at this holistically. And that was one of the reasons that the House of Representatives felt like we needed to move forward in terms of federal legislation. So I will conclude my comments there. I'm happy to take any questions and or listen to the rest of the panel.
Thank you very much. And I think what I forgot to mention, and the commissioner didn't mention in her introduction, is that she is ours. She is an Oregonian. So many of us at the panel know her and have had the opportunity to work with Ms. Lewis in the past. Are there questions for this witness, Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Sharon, on chemical restraints, can you identify, did you do a laundry list of medications or chemicals? Is Ritalin included in that, or at what level?
Actually, what we did was, as opposed to getting into specifics, what we did is we defined chemical restraints as a drug or medication used on a student to control behavior or restrict freedom of movement that is not prescribed by a licensed physician for standard treatment and administered for the purpose as prescribed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Roebling.
Thank you. Sharon, a couple questions. The first one has to do with the GOA study was just a snapshot, right? We don't have any longitudinal data to indicate. I mean, one of the things that would be interesting to know was if the same kids are being restrained all the way through the system, or if the restraints in early ages led to no restraints of older kids of those same children. But we don't have that kind of study, do we?
No, we do not have that kind of study. We have about a half a dozen states that do collect the data on seclusion and restraint in the schools. Two of the states that we looked at, California and Texas, in a one-year period of time, had over 33,000 incidents reported. Within that, there seems to be a fair amount of duplication in terms of individual students. I think in Texas, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was you did have a tremendous number of students who were repeatedly restrained, and so the number of students affected is substantially less than the 14,000 or so incidents, but there is not longitudinal data. Now, one thing I did fail to mention is that the Department of Education, as part of their ongoing Office of Civil Rights data collection, added, as of this year, to their data collection, seclusion and restraint, that all schools who are in districts over 3,000 students that are involved in that survey across the country will begin to report that data, not unlike the data that they currently report on corporal punishment. So we will begin to have a better national data picture, but unfortunately Oregon is one of the states that we do not have clear data on.
Thank you. Representative
Maurer. Thanks, Madam Chair. Quick question. You use the term physician prescribing. Is that a generic term?
Actually, I think I'd have to pull the legislation. I know we did a technical on this so that it would allow for prescribing as based in state law.
Thank you.
Further questions for the Commissioner? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Just a quick question about now, has this bill passed the Senate and the House, or what is the current status?
The bill has passed the House. It is pending in the Senate. Senator Dodd has dropped the companion legislation. It's not clear the schedule in terms of taking that to a mark. I know that he is very interested in this legislation and giving his pending departure from the Senate after the elections this year. I would not be surprised to see some movement on it. I also know that Chairman Miller has publicly committed to including this in the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act as that moves forward if an independent vehicle doesn't move.
One follow-up. Is there any funds earmarked for this, particularly if it is tied to ESEA?
I don't know how it will play out if it's brought into ESEA, and I can't really comment on that because I think those are negotiations that other folks will be taking up. In the standalone bill that was passed, there are grant resources that are authorized, and you know, I think that if the legislation moves forward, I think that the administration has been strong in its commitment, and I would hope, and again, this is me speaking, not speaking on behalf of the administration, but I would hope that there would be resources to follow it. I would also wanted, and in acknowledging the administration's commitment to this, not only did Secretary Duncan send out the letter that I believe Representative Gelser has shared with you in terms of encouraging states to take a look at this, but the Secretary of Education also sent a December 2009 letter to Chairman Miller and Senator Dodd, encouraging the development of federal legislation, and that information, I can add that to the record if that's helpful, but I think that I would hope that that commitment would then ensure there would be some resources to follow.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. It's probably in the pile of information we have here, but could you tell us the bill number that has passed the House that you were referring to?
Sure. It's H.R. 4247.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I have a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you know, many schools no longer have school nurses, but for those schools that do the nurses tend to play a role in the restraint and seclusion process?
I'm not aware of any information that indicates that nurses have played a specific role in seclusion and restraint. The anecdotal data that we had in terms of who was most likely to participate in a seclusion and restraint incident showed that it, and again, this is anecdotal without good data, showed that often it was paraeducators or special education staff engaged in these incidents.
Mm-hmm. Just a follow-up. It seems to me that, you know, in those schools where there is a nurse present, that there should be a role for the nurse to play just to help monitor the process, it seems.
I think, you know, based on best practices, you're right. One of the things that the federal legislation does is lays down criteria that in defining a training program and what we would hope that states would adopt, that each state has to define their own protocol for what is an acceptable certification or training. And part of what is incorporated into the federal legislation is an expectation that folks have basic first aid and CPR training.
Thank you.
This is Sarah. Can you clarify for me what the difference is between an incident of seclusion and an incident of detention or timeout or sending someone to the office?
Sure. In the federal legislation, we utilized the definitions as they exist in federal law through the Children's Health Act of 2000 that defines seclusion as in statute as locked, that an individual has to be alone in a locked environment, which is different, and we did include in the legislation also a definition of time out, which is a behavior management technique that is part of an approved program and may involve the separation of the student from a group in a non-locked setting for the purpose of calming.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, this one comes because of a question just came, and that has to do with have you noticed any, as these issues become more scrutinized, the use of local police officers to restrain rather than the staff of the school, and that they don't have to follow the same techniques, including use of restraint?
Anecdotally, we've heard that concern that schools will simply resort to calling the police. Again, without data collection, I don't know. We've seen a few of those stories, but we had seen those stories even in states that have no requirements around school personnel and seclusion and restraint. One of the things in the federal legislation that is incorporated is that school resource officers are considered as in the definition of school personnel, along with, you know, nurses and librarians and bus drivers and folks who perform services for the school on a contractual basis, in terms of being subject to needing training before they engage in seclusion or restraint.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for making time this morning. Do you want to hang on the phone, or do you want us to hang you up?
You know what? I can hang on the phone for about another 15 minutes.
All right. And I'm going to...
I will put you on mute.
All right. And I'm going to do the same to you. Is that this red button here? Right. Is that the mute?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. And next up.
I can't hear. If you mute her, she can't hear.
If I mute, you can't hear us, so I'm not going to put you on mute. Thank you, committee, for setting me straight on the wonders of modern technology. Usually it's my middle school daughter that keeps me on track. Mr. Edwards. Welcome. Thank you for coming this morning. And if you would please start by identifying yourself for the record, that would be most helpful.
My name is Ed Edwards. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Specialized Offices for the Oregon School Employees Association, which represents approximately 21,000 education staff in the state of Oregon. And we are located at 4735 Liberty Road South here in Salem, 97302.
Can you pull the microphone just a little bit closer?
Okay.
Thank you.
How's that?
Much better.
All right. Well, first, let me thank the chair for inviting us here today. This issue that you're talking about currently is of particular interest to OSCA and has been for a number of years. Let me start off by saying that OSCA, in principle, supports the legislation that was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives. And through our affiliation with the American Federation of Teachers, we, are, of course, are working at the federal level to try to make this bill even better as it moves through the Senate. I've submitted testimony for your review. I just want to take this opportunity to just sort of highlight some of our concerns or issues in regards to the federal legislation, and also to the point that if, as we have in the past in Oregon, when a federal law is passed, we have sat down here and had hearings about those that legislation and actually improved upon the legislation. So we are hopeful that if we are unsuccessful at the federal level and this bill does become federal law, that the Oregon legislature will take up this bill next session or whenever and try to address some of the issues that OSCA really believes that are glaring omissions and also problems within the federal law legislation that's being considered. I want to start off with the federal legislation that's moving. We have a real concern about funding on this issue, as every school district in the state would as they read this bill. This is new requirements, new mandates, new reporting requirements, etc. As I went through the bill, of course, I was looking, okay, what's the Fed going to do about paying for the additional costs related to this bill? Unfortunately, it's become very popular at the federal level to develop grant programs these days and then ask districts to submit applications to pay for the mandate that they dealt us. I guess that is just the way of we do things today. I don't think that is necessarily appropriate in this particular case. The safety of students, able or disabled, is an absolute issue that needs our attention. I think this hearing, the federal legislation, is extremely important. We shouldn't be guessing whether or not our students are being restrained and secluded in a way that is harmful to them. And we should not, and also we should not have an environment where in a school which its purpose is education, have staff be exposed or have to deal with unregulated, you know, violence caused by students against staff. This is a huge problem here in Oregon. Let me just make it very clear. It's an issue OSCA has been dealing with for a couple of years now. We are trying to collect data. It's very, very difficult. Members of ours are reluctant to talk about it. Districts are reluctant to talk about it, deal with it, or fix it at the district level. It is sort of this silent thing that's going on within our schools. Students assaulting and injuring staff, especially in the special ed environment. Small to large school districts basically are not adequately can adequately deal with this issue. The legal system is such that at times they're reluctant to deal with this issue appropriately. So I think legislation like this is very, very important. So I talked to you about funding. I also want to address the fact that implementing this law is going to be difficult between smaller and larger school districts, and I think that's an issue that really needs to be talked about extensively, not just at the federal level, but in here in Oregon. Training. Unfortunately, education support staff, classified employees working in our schools today, sort of are at the end of the line when it comes to funding professional training opportunities to prepare our members to do their job in the best, efficient, and safe way possible. We have training here in Oregon for special ed assistants. I think it requires like a week or so. But there is no real follow-through with that training. There's no updating that's going on with our members. And believe it or not, we do have districts, and I have members who are telling us that even though they've been through the training, their district is telling them not to use it, not to use the training that they've been given. And dealing with student violence against staff, they've been given heavy coats to wear to protect them from students who are biting them or hitting them, throwing objects at them. Injuries that cause our members to take time off, not covered by workers' comp because they're not out long enough. They're out for one day to recover from an injury, being punched or hit. They're taking their sick leave to handle that, and a lot of our special ed assistants are running out of sick leave because they're being injured on the job. Training will help, I think. Adequate training to deal with these issues and deal with student violence and behavior that needs to be restrained or if a student needs to be in seclusion. I'll tell you, I wish we didn't have to do either. Our job of our members is to educate students. But to be all-inclusive, this is a reality within our schools. So one of the glaring omissions that we would hope that if it doesn't pass in the federal sector, that if Oregon looks at this similar legislation, is to require the reporting of staff injuries and assaults caused by students, to require this type of reporting to occur in all of our school districts. We believe firmly that without that data, all the data that the feds are requiring is going to be absolutely meaningless. Why? Because our districts, our administrators, supervisors, and staff are going to see this bill with all its new requirements, with all the all the reporting, additional reporting, and the liability now with this law upon districts who do not comply, plus the penalties that the federal government has within the law for non-compliance. That there is an built-in incentive in this law that will tell our administrators and districts, let's not use restraint and seclusion. And we will establish policies that minimizes, absolutely minimizes, the use of restraint and seclusion. Now, that would, this is how I see it playing out. There will be a dramatic drop in restraint and seclusion of students, which I think is an absolute positive thing, and so would our members. But if that is accompanied with a major increase in injuries to staff, then that is an unintended consequence that the federal folks and here in Oregon need to be aware of and then try to figure out how to address it. OSCA supports this legislation at the federal level, but we want to make it whole and we want the data to be complete so we can see exactly how and what happens when it gets into the classroom, it gets into the school building. And I want to personally thank Chair Gelser for making this issue a priority, to have it at the top of your agenda and to have this meeting today, and look forward to participating in this discussion in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Will we have time to make a couple of comments?
Depending on how many questions we ask. Yes.
Okay. Because I don't necessarily have a question for this witness.
Okay.
Witness?
He, w- witnessed a lot, I'm sure.
Representative Zimbardo, you look like you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ed, welcome. So is there any connection between, you know, you mentioned small districts, you know, as having particular challenges, certainly for training. How about in terms of workload? Are there connections there? Do we, in your experience, tend to see more negative incidents when we have, you know, a bigger workload problem for the assistants? What can you say about that?
Well, you know, again, I do not have data on that. I do know that during, you know, budget crises like we're going through today, that, you know, the special ed classroom is not immune from cuts, and as far as, you know, staffing, what they normally do will cut hours rather than eliminating staff. I think in smaller districts, I have not heard from our members that we really have a staffing issue in regards to dealing with students who are, whose emotional or behavioral have problems and need attention. As I go out to meetings, for instance, and I generate conversation about this now. You know, you hear stories that most Oregonians just, you know, would never think of. And it shows the length in which Oregon will go to make sure that all students are getting an adequate, free, and appropriate public education. When one of our special ed assistants will say that, you know, we have three assigned staff to walk with one student through the hallways because there is a potential that that student may have an issue and get out of hand, and that that particular student would have to be restrained. That, you know, it sounds odd, and you go, you know, maybe that's not right, but, you know, that student's in school, that student is learning, and that's, and I think that is very, very important. When I was growing up, there were no disabled in the schools I went to from elementary all the way through high school.
Because they weren't allowed.
Right. They went to a special school. Never learned how to, you know, I didn't even know there were disabled people, actually, especially kids. Today, it's a whole different world, and we're learning how to work with that. And that's why, you know, we're very, very supportive of legislation that moves us in the direction of making sure that this works and making it good for everyone.
Thank you. Any Representative Van Orman?
Well, I'd like to make a comment, if I may.
Of course.
You know, having been in the Head Start business for 26 years ago, when we started, you know, Head Start has a rule, 10% of the children meet special needs criteria. They have to be diagnosed as kids with special needs. Over the years, that percentage increased to almost 20% of all the kids in our Head Start program. And over the years, more and more children were exhibiting behavioral issues that were very difficult for staff to manage. Now, Head Start invests a lot in training. And when I was there, there were three paid people in the classroom for 18 kids. And they were not well paid, by the way. But there were two teachers and a bus driver teacher aide. The difficulty is as the children's issues progressed, staff was asking for much more training for behavior management, which we tried to provide, and sometimes it's not easy to get. And the other issue was lack of resources for the staff. When serious issues were developed, there was nowhere to turn. We couldn't get them into any mental health services because there was a waiting list. So in many ways, and the model has now changed where there's one teacher for 20 kids. So here you are, a teacher with children who have these issues, and it could be 10% of your class, could be 20%. But asking people to deal with these issues without adequate training and without some support other than the teacher, it's an impossible task. And I think that's one of the serious issues that we have, is that there are lack of resources when we have children who are exhibiting these behaviors. And I've had teachers hurt, and I've had a bus driver out for a week.
Thank you. Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. The comment I'd like to make is when you have a student with disabilities, the student is approached with a team support system. I'm concerned that we're losing, or the part of the discussion isn't here, about the student's individual education plan. If you have an individual education plan that is being successful, these issues are dealt with, and then the lead administrator, teacher, whoever, has the legal responsibility to make sure that that child is, first of all, in a safe environment for themselves, and then second of all, safe to the rest of the classroom. And so there's a much, much bigger format of things that need to be addressed here. And the only comment I would like to make is the fact that one of the first jobs I ever had in the school, and I only had it for 2 days, was the fact that I applied for a teaching assistant in a special ed classroom. And the first day, the teacher tied up the student for 3 hours straight with no break, no bathroom, no water, no nothing. And so we had a talk after school, and she asked me how the day went, and I said, well, my day went fine, but I'm concerned about the student you put behind the closet door for 3 hours. And she says, you have no right to question or judge me on that, and if you have problems with that, then you probably need to quit. And so the next day, I thought, well, we'll see. We'll give it another day. Same thing happened. And so then I went to the principal, and I shared, I can't tolerate this. And so there's two sides of this, and again, from the classified position, what do you have, your other choice? If you think that something is happening that is wrong, then you don't have a job. And, this has been going on, and it needs to be addressed. And it starts with what Representative Van Orme is talking about, is good professional development, and then a system that surrounds that child in that classroom that works and works together.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Edwards. And I know that Representative Comp passed me a note and asked about another organization testifying. This is obviously an issue that impacts many organizations, many agencies, many people. As a first hearing, we can't get everyone here today. The goal for today is to set the overview, have a staff perspective. We're going to have a perspective from advocates and students coming up next. But this is the beginning of our discussions, certainly. Certainly not the end. I appreciate the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
Great. And next we have Mr. Jundeff and Ms. Schenck. Welcome. And if you will start, as you always do, by introducing yourself. For the record, that would be most helpful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights of Oregon. And with me today is Chris Schenck, who's an attorney in our office, who specializes in the area of special education. Thank you very much for this opportunity. You know, our organization is designated by the governor to be Oregon's protection and advocacy system. And we're one of 57 protection advocacy systems around the country. And even though we're an independent nonprofit, we receive federal money to advocate on behalf of people with disabilities, and that includes children in the special education system. Special education advocacy is something that we've done for 33 years, and during those many years, of course, having limited funding like most agencies, we've really had to concentrate in on the most difficult cases, and those usually involve children who are being excluded from school, who are at risk of being excluded, or have some sort of severe difficulty in receiving their education. The area of seclusion and restraint is one that we're very familiar with. For the last 5 years or so, it has been one of our top priorities in order to address not only on an individual level, but on a systemic level. So even though we continue to do our individual cases, when parents social workers and others contact us with concerns about a child's education. We've worked with the Department of Education. We've worked with other advocates to try to address this problem. And that's led us to work on rules with the Department of Education and to seek to monitor those rules as a step of trying to take an overall look at the problem. And it's also involved our working with our national partners and with Commissioner Lewis to try to look at federal remedies as well. So Chris Shank is here today to tell you a little bit about what this issue really means in the down and dirty individual cases, and to tell you a little bit about the data that we've been able to collect about how Oregon is doing right now. So.
Thank you. Ms. Shank, if you can start by introducing yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Shank, and as Bob mentioned, I advocate for students with special education needs. In the course of my work, I have heard many stories of children who have been improperly restrained and secluded while at school. Oregon has long regulated the use of restraint and seclusion in their mental health facilities, but until 2007, we had nothing in place to protect students in our schools. So in 2007, we worked with our colleagues at the Department of Education, urging them to develop rules to address this matter. And while those rules were a significant step in the right direction, they didn't go far enough to achieve our goal of safe schools. We continued to hear from parents across the state whose children were being restrained and secluded in manners that weren't appropriate. I've included many stories in the materials that you've received this morning, and all of those are students who I've represented since 2007, since those new rules came into place. So we still have an issue in our state. I'm going to share just one story with you this morning. I represented a six-year-old student with a communication disorder who was placed in a self-contained classroom. In the course of the first 5 months of this first grader's school year, he was restrained 14 times, and he was placed in seclusion 15 times. Just to be clear, seclusion in our state is defined as involuntary confinement of a student alone in a room from which they are prevented from leaving. So it is different from timeout, as Sharon explained, where a student chooses to take a break. This six-year-old was confined alone in a room for up to 3 hours a day, some days more than once a day. He would get so upset he would hit his head against the wall. He frequently broke his glasses. He would tell his parents that he didn't want to go to school. His parents had no idea how long he was in the seclusion room for or how many times a day it was happening. Staff were being injured in the course of restraints. One day, the student came home with abrasions on his back, and that's when his parents realized how serious the situation had become at school. They requested a more supportive setting for him and kept him out of school until they were granted that request. That was 1 year ago. That student attended school at a more supported setting. He achieved all of his goals in that setting, and he is now reintegrating into a regular education, regular elementary school, and he's had no serious behavioral issues since. That story and the others that I've included in your material demonstrate that when our staff get proper training and when students get proper supports, behavior can be managed without the ongoing use of physical restraint and seclusion. The students that I've represented received changes to their educational program in part because their parents retained legal counsel. Of course, we would all like to see these problems be solved before anybody has to retain an attorney. Because we continue to receive calls from parents who had concerns about this issue, we decided to take a closer look at what's going on in our state. So we sent out a public records request to all the districts in Oregon. We received 105 responses to that request, and we'd like to thank our colleagues at the Department of Education who encouraged the districts to respond. So that's about half the districts responded to our public records request. And while we're pleased with that response, we're also aware that we're missing valuable information from the other half of our state. So we compiled some data from that information that we received, and I'll share just a few points with you this morning. Of the 105 districts that we heard from, 72 districts have policies that fully comply with the Oregon administrative rules. 13 districts informed us that at the time of our public records request, they had no policy in place regarding restraint and seclusion in their districts. So that's just over 10% of those that we heard from. Many of those districts assured us that they have now proposed policies for their boards to consider, and they feel confident that those will be in place by next school year. An additional 14 districts responded to our request and submitted policies that fall short of providing the protections necessary under the administrative rules. Another part of the Oregon rules requires that each district have a documented process for annual review of restraint and seclusion in their district. There's, just to be clear, there's no requirement that any data come out of that process, just that there is a documented process. So we requested that the district send us anything that they had, the documented process or data that came out of the annual review. Not surprisingly, our response to this was more disappointing. 57 districts did not respond to that at all. So over half of the districts that had responded to the policy request did not respond to the annual review. 13 districts proudly informed us that they had no use of restraint or seclusion in their district, which is great. There were 10 districts that were able to provide us with data from their annual review. In those 10 districts, which represent just 5% of the districts in our state, children were restrained more than 400 times. That does not include data from any of the 5 largest districts in our state, so we know that number is far, far higher. The vast majority of those restraints were imposed on our youngest children. More than 3/4 of those restraints happened in elementary schools. The districts reported that individual students were restrained more than 25 times. Some of those restraints lasted for more than 2 hours. When these incidents occur, they're very troublesome for everyone involved. They are often traumatic for the student who is placed in restraint or seclusion. They're hard on the students who witness the restraint, and they're very, very difficult for the staff who have to administer that restraint. The good news is that we know that many of these situations can be avoided. We know because we've worked with students who have been repeatedly restrained and secluded until they received the proper supports and were placed in a setting with properly trained staff who had the tools that they needed to avoid the use of restraint and seclusion. We know because select mental health facilities across the country have made it a priority to eliminate the use of restraint and seclusion, and they have largely been able to achieve that goal and better outcomes for their clients. We know because we have a district in our state who made this a priority and were able to see the great outcomes. One of the 10 districts that provided us with data provided us with information from their annual review for both 2007-2008 and 2008-2009. This is a medium-sized district in our state. In 2007-2008, the students in this district were restrained 72 times, all of those in elementary schools. 54 of those restraints happened in one elementary school. The district did their annual review, they saw the information, and they decided to address it. They provided training and supports. The following year, that same district with those same children dropped the number of restraints to 9. The school that had 54 restraints the following year had 1. By training their staff in how to avoid the use of physical restraint and seclusion, how to properly administer restraint and seclusion, how to recognize and help a child who's experiencing anxiety to de-escalate, and by recognizing the signs of sensory integration issues, this district was able to achieve what we are hoping for all of our schools. To accomplish this, we need your help. We all know that students learn best in a safe environment. That's common sense. We need clear guidance from our legislature that safe schools are a top priority so all staff can receive the training and tools that they need to make this happen. We need enforceable minimum safety standards in our schools. Right now, our regulations are not enforceable. We need legislation that provides for independent review and administrative oversight of the use of restraint and seclusion in our schools. And we need to refocus our attention of our schools on providing a safe school environment for the benefit of all the students and all the staff who work with them. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. And I have a question to start off with. Among the school districts that responded, did Portland Public Schools respond to your request?
We have been able to get their policies off of the internet, but we did not get any annual review data from them.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions, Representative Roblin?
Yeah, just a quick one. We heard from the LCA person about is there a rise in injuries, both the students and his staff, and his particular staff? Was there any collection of that data in any of the reviews? So we don't really know that, right?
We did not get any information about staff injuries. We support the idea of collecting data on that as well.
Yeah.
Representative Springer and then Representative Mauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for your testimony. I'm making an assumption here, so correct me if I'm incorrect. Unless a school district has a fairly sophisticated policy on seclusion and restraint, there is no requirement that parents be notified when there is an action of seclusion or restraint?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, thanks for the question. Our current regulations do require that parents be notified on the same day that the restraint or seclusion occurs, verbally or in writing. But they do not have to provide any information about how long that lasts or how many times a day. Like, they could just call and tell you that your child was restrained or secluded today.
Hello, please. Certainly looking through some of these two, three, or four incidents here that you talked about and some of this other information, doesn't look like that's occurring. In any respectable fashion.
Oftentimes it is missed.
Thank you. Representative Mauer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One of the issues I have with the federal law that appears to be rolling up the hill is the issue of definitions. And you know, if there's a federal mandate that's associated with this law, I think we're probably going to go the wrong direction because there's not going to be the money to push the information to the feds. How consistent is our language with what the feds are proposing? Because I think a lot of this in reporting is assuring that you have consistent definitions so that a restraint is a restraint, a seclusion is a seclusion, and we're not mixing apples and oranges. Can you give me any information on that?
Sure, Madam Chair. Representative Moore, thanks for the question. Our physical restraint definition is consistent with the federal definition for the most part. Our seclusion definition is it omits the locked piece, but it achieves the same effect for just having them prevented from leaving. We don't currently have a ban on mechanical restraint or chemical restraint, so we have no definitions on those.
Follow up. I guess I'm having some issues. Does the LSBA have a standardized policy that school boards are asked to implement?
They do offer a standard policy. Yeah.
Okay. Is that a complete policy, or would you ask them to? So a little more in depth.
The 72 districts, most of the 72 districts that adopted the OSBA policy, there's two pieces to it. There's an OSBA policy and then the procedures that go along with it. So some districts only adopted the policy piece of it, and then they're missing a lot of the information from the procedures. I don't know if that's just a misunderstanding or, you know, not looking through their forms all the way. But so the procedures are the ones that detail notifying parents and that kind of thing. So those districts would be out of compliance. In addition, some districts decided to adopt policy language that varied from the OSBA policies.
Can
I
follow up?
No, I have concerns that the feds are going to muck this up and and make this more difficult, and we don't achieve anything that Oregon needs to do, because I think the ball may be rolling in the right direction here, just with a little more education and a little more oomph push from you folks, and I appreciate what you do.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative Mauer, 2 points. One is that, of course, we don't have a federal bill yet, and given the state of the U.S. Senate, that's hardly a done deal. One other point that I think is important in our state legislation is that right now families do not have the ability to appeal the appropriateness of a seclusion and restraint and send it to the state for an administrative review, and that's something that we think would be very important to be included in legislation here.
Thank you. Any Representative Dimbro?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, thank you for the examples and the data. And I'd like just to drill down a little bit on what might be some examples of proper supports, you know, that can really make a difference. You had mentioned that one district that, you know, really dramatically reduced its use of seclusion and restraint. How did they do that? And, I mean, just give us some ideas of how we can move forward with this.
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough, thanks for the question. That district, I don't have a lot of information, but they did include in their annual report that they provided training on occupational therapy techniques, and they listed specifically brain gym techniques that they found very helpful in their districts. A lot of the behaviors that escalate come from students who are experiencing anxiety or if they're in a setting that's just too overstimulating for them. So I think the real key in behavior management is recognizing the signs early enough that you can intervene before the behavior escalates to a point that you have to physically manage the student. So it really depends on the individual student what training is going to be appropriate, but it's really about understanding the student and their disability in a way that you're going to be able to identify those early warning signs.
Thank you. Yes, there are more follow-ups. Representative Van Orman and then Representative Roman.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelser. Well, it does, what you have just said does fall into Representative Comp's comment about individual education plan. And hopefully when those plans are developed, that there are professional people to help. And sometimes that's not always the case. I don't know if that's an assumption on my part, but that's my experience, that we don't always have adequate resource.
Thank you. Representative
Roblin. Were there ever, when you looked at the restraints in Oregon, were all of them special needs students with IEPs, or were there some regular ed students who were not, or did it give you the information to know that?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, thanks for the question. They didn't delineate in their annual reporting. I do have a student whose story is in your packet that was a regular education student when he was restrained. So I do know it happens. I think the vast majority of students are special education, but it does occur in the regular ed environment as well.
Thank you very much. Any final comments or questions? Thank you both very much, and thank you for everyone that took the time to come today and testify on this issue. For the committee, this is an issue that I anticipate we will be working on next session. I tend to agree with Mr. Jundiff. While I'm hopeful and would fully support the federal government moving forward with some nationwide standards, I think that we are much more likely to be able to take the ball and direct it and move it forward and exert some leadership on this and hopefully meet Representative Harker's criteria of being number one in something. And that would be keeping our kids safe in school. So, thank you all very much. We are going to move on at 9:15 to the role of athletics in our higher education system. We will get to the update on the All-Prep Academies at 9:45, and we are going to take a quick 5-minute break. So the committee is in recess.
The House Committee on Education will come back to order. Welcome back, and welcome to all the new people who have joined us in the room for the next segment of our meeting. We will be talking for the next half an hour about the role of athletics in the university system, also known as, I think we're going to talk a little bit about the Mike Bellotti situation. We have folks here from the Department of Justice and from the University of Oregon and the Oregon University System, thank you. And before we bring up the OUS folks, I'd like to start with the Department of Justice. So Attorney General John Kroger, please.
Good morning. Chair Gelser, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. I'm joined by David Leith, who's the Associate Attorney General. And by way of preliminary statement, very briefly, Representative, as you know, we did conduct a legal review of the adequacy of legal services at the University of Oregon with respect to the Bellotti matter. Our review found absolutely no evidence of criminal or intentional wrongdoing of any sort. We did find that the legal representation was deficient in that certain key terms of the agreement between the university and Mr. Bellotti, the athletic director, were never memorialized in writing. That failure to reduce the terms of the agreement to writing resulted in increased uncertainty and risk for the university, and the $2.3 million payment plus interest, which was made by the university to resolve the matter, was, in my judgment, a not unreasonable business decision by the university president to resolve the matter given the degree of uncertainty and risk. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions? That's all? Questions? No?
Thank you, Chair Gelser and Attorney General Kroger. The only question I have is just a clarification. Were there any public general fund monies used in this transaction?
Chair Gelser, Representative Comp, my understanding is that no public funds were used, and I'll just ask the Associate AG to confirm that.
That's our understanding.
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Chair Gelser, I'm David Leith, the Associate Attorney General. Chair Gelser, Representative Comp, it's our understanding that the University of Oregon has arranged to use non-general fund monies entirely to pay the amounts and to satisfy the separation obligations to Coach Bellotti.
Thank you. I just wanted that on the record.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions before the Attorney General leaves? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, are there any, do you know of any other non-written contracts out there?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, that's a very important question. No, we're not aware of any significant outstanding contracts with the state universities that have not been memorialized in writing.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. But then again, did you know about this one beforehand?
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, no, we did not.
Uh-huh. So there could be some hanging out there. Just don't know about.
And Mr. Attorney General, are there any documents or reports that your office has produced that would be available to members of the public that wanted to better understand the work that you did, the review that you did?
Chair Gelser, absolutely. There's an Attorney General's review report, which goes through all of the facts that we are able to determine and our legal conclusions, and that is available to the public, and I can provide you with an electronic copy that could be disseminated to the public by the committee.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind getting that to Cheyenne, then we can direct. I know that I received some requests for that information over the weekend, and we can disseminate it through the committee administrator.
Happy to do it.
Any further questions?
I have just a quick one.
Member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the procedures for doing this kind of review, I know there was also an internal audit division review of the matter. So does your agency work together with them, or are these completely independent reviews? And how does that work?
Chair Gelser, Representative Dembro, in this case, there were two separate independent reviews that were going forward, one being conducted by the Chancellor's office and one by my office. And because they were independently initiated, but because they were reviewing the same material, we coordinated those two reviews to the extent of ensuring that both inquiries were providing each other with other facts that we have been able to determine, and we cooperated with respect to the release dates of the finding of the two. So I would say that they were supplementary, the Chancellor's review looking at business practices, our review looking at the adequacy of legal services.
Mm-hmm. But just to follow up, but you would say that the conclusions that you reached were independently reached. Would that be fair to say?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Dembro, yes, I think that's an adequate statement or an accurate statement.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Dembro, yes, I think that is an accurate statement.
Thank you very much. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Is it fair to assume that what has occurred is an aberration of the transition between who was in charge, or do you think it's a common practice or has been a common practice?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, the legal services provided to the state universities are done through a mechanism which is different from any other mechanism we have in state government. At every other agency, my assistant AGs are the lawyers for those agencies. At the state universities, going back to the time of Dave Frohnmayer, we've had a separate arrangement of the universities hiring special assistant attorneys general to be their lawyers. And it's kind of a hybrid designed to both ensure that I can supervise the legal work of those lawyers, but also that they are hired and responsible in many respects to the university presidents. I think what we saw here was a combination of deficient legal services being provided by the special assistant AG in place and a failure of communication between the attorneys at the University of Oregon and my office. And that breakdown of communication is one which, in the report, I attribute to both institutions and certainly take responsibility for insofar as it's my job to make sure that all state entities, whether they have my lawyers or special assistant AGs, have outstanding legal services. I think that breakdown in communication comes from a lot of historical and institutional cultural things. Obviously, had we known at the Department of Justice that there was a major contract outstanding that had never been memorialized in an agreement, we would have intervened to take steps to make sure that that contract was drafted immediately. So I think this is I think it could be viewed as an aberration in that I don't think we have a systematic breakdown in the quality of the legal services being provided to the state universities. However, I do think the unique model of providing legal services we've adopted allowed a breakdown in communication to occur, which prevented both my predecessor, Hardy Myers, and myself from taking steps that we would have taken had we been aware of what was happening.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next I would invite up Representative Holvey, the Chancellor, and President LaRiviere. Representative Holvey, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity and the honor to introduce the new president of the University of Oregon, Dr. Richard LaRiviere. I wish that the circumstances...
Representative Holvey, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have strange rules here, and you have to identify yourself.
State Representative Paul Holvey, House District 8. Thank you for reminding me of the protocol. I've been out of the service for a little while. going back to my statement, I wish the circumstances were a little different in introducing Dr. LaRiviere, a fabulous gentleman who I have met and is new to the university and has come to the university and been thrust into some major issues, this being one of them, of course, but I will note that he comes to us with some incredible credentials, and he was recently from the University of Kansas, where he served as Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost at the University of Kansas, and before that was the Dean of College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas of Austin, and received his doctorate in Sanskrit from the University of Pennsylvania, which I first thought was something to do with Star Wars, but I have been corrected that it is not.
It wasn't.
But he has a long list of credentials, and I really admire his ability to step into a situation with a great candor and engage folks with meaningful dialogue about the situations that he sees at the University of Oregon. I think that his conversations are going to be critical to this legislature in trying to figure out how we deal with funding our OUS system and our universities, essentially. I will say his ability to cut to the chase and get right to the point of things has been something that has impressed me. And he does not step back away from a conversation and being quite frank with how he sees any situation that I've noticed in the university in the state of Oregon. I am really looking forward to him as a partner in helping us deal with funding our university system, but more importantly, maintaining our public mission and providing access to education as being fundamental, which I think this committee should really, and I know you will be, engaging in that conversation. So with that, it's my honor to introduce Dr. Richard LaRiviere.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, and I would just add my gratitude for your willingness to step into the fire in a new situation, and to acknowledge my respect for the new president was increased by his willingness to have our first meeting together in the administrative buildings of Oregon State University deep in Beaverland. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is Richard LaRiviere. I'm the president of the University of Oregon. And let me begin, Madam Chair, by thanking Representative Holvey for that wonderful introduction that my mother would have found absolutely accurate and my father would have found pretty amusing. I don't want to take a great deal of time because I want to respond to your questions, but as you heard from the Attorney General, we found a situation where the athletic director had no written contract. This came as a surprise to many of us, certainly to me. The athletic director was not had a situation where he had to make a decision about the rest of his career, and I wanted him to make a certain decision, so I encouraged him to take advantage of the opportunity with ESPN. It was at that moment that I discovered there was no contract and we had to come to some arrangement whereby we treated him fairly but protected the interests of the university, and that's essentially what we ended up doing, I think. We have, I think, made it very clear to everyone who works at the university that everyone who needs a contract better have one. And while I can't be absolutely certain of anything, I'm fairly certain that people at least understand that now. With that, let me just stop and ask any questions, answer any questions that you may have.
And before we move to the questions, would you like to briefly describe what the document is that was just passed out to us? Oh, that's yours. I'm sorry. Questions for the president.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Mr. President. It's, of course, an honor to have you here. I I guess it just only now dawned on me that this is our first formal reception of you in this room, and I'm sure it won't be our last, and I look forward to more. We've talked a lot about the written contract, unwritten contract, and I feel pretty satisfied with where that is. But I'd like to have us look just for a moment at the decision to, you know, if I can be blunt about it, buy out the athletic director's contract. That is a hefty amount of money that was, passed on in this settlement. And I'm just wondering, what is it that, in looking at what's good for the university, that would rise to the level of a multi-million-dollar settlement like that? I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, that's a very reasonable question, and I thank you for asking it. When Mike Bellotti told me about his ESPN opportunity, I encouraged him to take it because I told him that it was not going to work for him to continue as the athletic director. That's when he told me that he had no contract. That's when he told me that we owed him a great deal of money as a result of his employment relationship. A very great deal of money. Pretty surprising number. I, of course, immediately asked the general counsel what his contract called for, and that's when I discovered there was no contract. Given the fact that there was no contract, I found myself in suddenly a very strong position negotiating with someone whom I was essentially asking to leave the university eventually, although we, by that point, had reached a mutual agreement that that was the right thing to do. And I explained to Mr. Bellotti that this was the case, that there was no contract, and that we really basically had no further obligation to him. That's when he revealed to me the even further surprising fact that he had for a number of years during his tenure at the university worked for long periods of time without a written contract, or with a contract whose provisions had expired and had been renewed verbally but not been memorialized. So now the legal landscape shifted from one of great advantage for the university to one in which Mr. Bellotti had a reasonable assumption that the pattern of his previous 20 years' employment was continuing, and it changed everything. It was his understanding as athletic director that he had a contract similar to that of when he was a coach, that is a sort of rolling, my understanding is a rolling five-year contract. In order for that to have been the case, we would have had to have the approval of the chancellor for his employment under those circumstances. And there was no record of that whatsoever. So the notion of a five-year contract had been basically eliminated by that fact. Then I asked the general counsel what was the longest possible contract he could have had without having the formal approval of the chancellor, and my understanding was that was 3 years. He had served 1 year, so the maximum exposure that we could have had was the 2 years remaining on his contract. He was paid $675,000 a year, so 675 times two. And then I discovered in the course of all of this that there had been verbal commitments made to him that he would be paid an additional amount of money to effect the transition from a high-paying football coach to a, well, still pretty high-paying athletic director. The remaining portion of that verbal commitment was $900,000. So when you add those two figures together and round it off, it comes to $2.3 million. That's the maximum amount that we could possibly have owed Mr. Bellotti, in my view, and the maximum amount reasonably that a court might find that he was due. Mr. Bellotti had served the university nobly and well throughout his career. There was money available for this, specifically for this purpose, from donors. it seemed a reasonable way to get Mr. Bilotti to agree and to be done with this matter rather than to invoke the possibility of a lawsuit, the costs attendant to that, the risk to the university, etc. I was not very pleased to have to pay that much. Mr. Bilotti was certainly not very pleased to have to accept that much compared to what he wanted. The Attorney General's investigation, as he just told you, indicated that this was not unreasonable settlement, buyout. So I think it was the right number. Is it a lot of money? You bet it's a lot of money. Is it a lot of money, particularly in an educational context? It's a staggering amount of money. On the other hand, we have to remember that this is not the world of education. It's the world of entertainment. And what the athletic director at the University of Oregon is responsible for is maintaining ensuring the proper operation of a $70 million a year enterprise, whose job it is to provide, first and foremost, entertainment to people. In the bargain, we get 515 young people's education paid for. We get a fair bit of mind share purchased through this from the public. On balance, it's a wonderful thing for the university. But it is an entirely different realm than that of education and research, which is our fundamental mission.
Thank you. And if you have one more quick question, we've got about 5 minutes left and still have the chancellor.
It's probably not a quick question, or it's a quick question. It's probably not a quick answer, so maybe we can get that in another context. But just the basic question of, you said that the funds for this settlement were provided. There were dedicated funds that could be used that could not be used for other purposes. And I'm just wondering how that works exactly. What kinds of strings tend to be attached to donations on the athletic side through the foundation?
Well, my understanding is that these funds had been donated by supporters specifically for the compensation of Mike Bilotti in this circumstance. And, under the rules of the IRS, once a donor has given money, they no longer can direct the funds. But the purpose of the donation in the first place, we really have to honor. Otherwise, our relationship with donors is sacrificed.
Thank you. And just a final follow-up. I appreciate that. But that kind of attachment really troubles me. When money is being donated for a particular individual, as opposed to a program or some kind of endowed chair where the person who inhabits that chair will change. But when it's tied to a particular individual for a public institution, I find that troubling.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, I understand that very well. I should be a little careful how I characterize the exact legal structure here, because I frankly don't know. I haven't seen those donor agreements. These are explanations that have been provided to me by legal counsel. I don't think that the money was given specifically for Mike Bilotti. I think it was to effect a transfer between a football coach and an athletic director. It redounded to Mike Bilotti's benefit, obviously, but I think that's the legal structure that was in place. Having said all of that, we live in a very strange world, a world in which we happily pay $20 million to a 19-year-old actress to be in a movie, or $35 million to a 22-year-old pitcher to throw a baseball. And yet we can't find enough money to pay people who look after our pre-K children as much as we pay people who carry the groceries out in our grocery store. I would dearly love to live in a world that had a different set of values. I don't.
have a follow-up to Representative Dimbro's question. So if it is possible to make a contribution through a foundation for a particular purpose, whether that is directly to an individual or to effect a transfer, which is basically for an individual, if I am a booster of the University of Oregon and I'm a graduate of your economics department and I have an economics professor that I think is fantastic, I see that there are looming cuts in that economics department, can I rally all of my friends, neighbors, and the relatives of that particular professor and designate contributions in order to protect a position or an academic professorship or a specific professor and therefore drive your personnel and management decisions through your foundation?
The answer to that is no, with the following qualification. If a department, for example, had decided, Representative Gelser, that we were going to downsize and eliminate two or three jobs, universities don't ordinarily accept monies to protect an individual's job. If, however, someone came in and said, wait a minute, you are eliminating labor economics from the Department of Economics on the principle that you can't afford to pay for it, we are going to endow three positions in labor economics. We would accept that gift for that endowment and then choose the best people to hold those positions. Now, as a practical matter, presumably the three people whom we might in this hypothetical situation be eliminating, we had chosen, we had approved of their work, etc., we would probably hire those three people to fill those positions. But if someone came to me and said, we are going to give you this money on condition that you hire Sarah Smith, we wouldn't accept it. We couldn't accept it.
Thank you. Any final questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. So what I'm hearing is that the IRS, there are two parts of the question. One, if I give money, is it a tax-deductible contribution according to IRS? The second part is that the IRS then controls basically the rules of the foundation.
Yes.
In terms of money. Okay.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, that's my understanding.
Okay.
But keep in mind, my legal expertise ends somewhere around 1200 AD in India. So I don't want to be accused of practicing law here. But yes, that's my understanding.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, George Pernsteiner with the Oregon University System, and I will be very brief. When when Richard called me to tell me about the situation with Director Bilotti, I asked the Internal Audit Director to take a look at whether or not any laws, rules, or policies were followed to determine whether any tuition revenue or state appropriations would be or could be used for the separation agreement, and then to give us some an idea about best practice in athletic department employment and separation around the country. The Attorney General has already determined that laws and rules were not violated. However, some of our policies were probably not clear enough, and we are clarifying those. The second is that no tuition revenue, no state general fund were, are, or will be used for this. In fact, we have determined that the donations are available. The auditor has determined that with the foundation, so that problem will not occur. And we are, in fact, then making some changes, that some of which the president has already made on the campus, some of which we will be making by rule. One of those changes will be to clarify that presidents are responsible for athletic departments. That's a new best practice that has been proposed by both the NC2A and the Association of Governing Boards. We have allowed campuses to choose which administrator directs the work of the athletic department. We will now change that to the president, which is now the best practice. We're also clarifying a variety of policies with regard to employment and termination, and we'll be bringing rules to our board at its fall meeting that will deal with all those issues. But to summarize again, no general fund, no tuition dollars will be used for this arrangement. As the Attorney General indicated, no laws were violated, and we are, in fact, changing practices to be very clear about who is responsible for athletics, and, of course, that all contracts will be in writing. So, thank you.
Any questions for Chancellor or the rest of the panel before you leave? Representative Thatcher?
Thank you. Well, I'm relieved that no taxpayer dollars were used to pay this sum, but I'm wondering if there were a contract in place, would it have followed that taxpayer funds would have been used, or is it just vary depending on something?
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, it depends upon the funding sources for the individual department involved, and since there wasn't a contract, it's hard to know where it would have been paid from.
Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? And I never gave anyone the opportunity to ask Representative Holvey any questions. Thank you all very much. I appreciate your coming and taking the time. And and this is the internal audit, so if people have questions, they can get to you. And it's there for you. Thank you all very much. We are going to move on to the next section of our informational meeting, which is an update on the All Prep Web Academies and Ed Choices. And I wanted to make a couple of introductory remarks before we got into this presentation. And you may remember on the day that, at that time, I think we all believed it was going to be the last day of the legislative session in February, but we all came back for a second day. We had an interesting hearing where there were some questions the department had just started to receive back, responses to a letter that it had sent out early in the year in response to concerns about irregularity in financial enrollment practices in a certain group of schools. And I think we all had a lot of questions at the end of that. It's my understanding a lot of work has continued since that time, and we have invited the Department of Justice and the Department of Ed to give us an update of where that's at. Before we get into that, two very important disclaimers. We are talking about a very specific organization. This is not an organization that is representative of charter schools as a whole. And though this is an organization that did utilize online learning as a tool, this is certainly not representative of virtual schools or online schools. We've had a lot of discussion in this committee about the two largest online schools in the state, ORCA and ORVA, and this impacts those not at all, except for my understanding that they've been helpful in resolving some of the issues that have come up as a result. So as we listen to this and as the public does, I just ask that we keep in mind this is contained to a specific organization and should not be a reflection on charter schools generally or online schools in general. And with that, I would briefly invite up David Leith from the Department of Justice. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm David Leith, the Associate Attorney General, and thank you, Representative Gelser, Chair Gelser. I'm here really just to very simply confirm for the committee that the Department of Justice does have an ongoing investigation with respect to this particular organization, and to explain that to protect the integrity of that ongoing investigation, we're not able to share any further details of it at this time. But I can confirm for the committee that the Department of Justice is reviewing the matter.
Thank you very much. I would ask if there were questions, but my guess is you would not be able to answer them, so I will spare you needing to make that. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
And with that, I would invite up Morgan Allen and Cindy Hunt, who you have all met before.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I will turn the bulk of the presentation over to Ms. Hunt in a moment. But Just want to remind the committee that back in February, we were asked to come and give an update on some questions that we were asking about the Ed Choices All Prep family of charter schools. And at that time, we had just started to receive information back from school districts, had about 2 or 3 days, I believe, before the hearing to process some of that information. So we've been asked to come today to provide more information and give you an update into our investigation into the Ed Choices All Prep organization. We've provided the committee 3 documents that are going to be passed around. The first, which is a one-page color document, it's an organizational chart that sort of details all of the schools and the school districts that were operating within the Ed Choices All Prep family. And we've color-coded it with the status of which schools are open. There's some schools that their school districts have closed them, or their school boards are terminating their agreements. There's some schools that are going to continue to operate, and there's some schools that are going to be closing at the end of the year. And that chart is just to kind of help you get a sense of where all of these 13 entities are at this time. The second document that we've provided, and we did have our DOJ colleagues look at this as well, is just a timeline of major events, starting with the January 21st letter that we sent to the 6 school districts that sponsor these charter schools, so that you get a good sense of what has happened in the preceding months since the letter has gone out. And then the third and final document that we're providing for the committee today is a recent order that the superintendent issued demanding the release of confidential student records that were being held in an Ed Choices facility in Clackamas County. Despite good faith efforts on the part of the Department of Education and the Department of Justice to negotiate the release of those records, on at least 2 occasions we were denied access to those confidential student records, and Ms. Hunt will give you an update on that, which actually we have some good news to report on that. So just a couple final comments before I turn it over to Ms. Hunt. The first is, again, we are in an ongoing investigation mode, just as the Department of Justice is, so we know you have many questions, and we hope you'll be understanding that many of them we will not be able to provide answers for you today. But when we do have a final report, we will be happy to come back and provide that information to the committee. The second thing I like to say is that all of the school districts and administrators and superintendents that we've worked with up to this point have been very responsive, cooperative, and have taken appropriate steps and measures to remedy situations and practices that should not be occurring. So we want to thank them. They've been very forthcoming with information. Our folks have had lots of good meetings with those folks, and we feel confident that many of the issues that have been raised are being addressed at the local level. And the last comment I make, just to echo the chair's comments, specifically to the Oregon Connections Academy and the Oregon Virtual Academy, they are not part of this situation or this investigation. In fact, have been helpful as we have tried to find for the schools that are closing, trying to find placements for online placements for these students. They have been very helpful and have stepped up to try to see if there's any way that any of the slots that they may have that these students might fit into. So we thank them for that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Hunt.
Thank you. So Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. When we started this investigation, and the focus of our technical assistance for the last 3 months has really been around 3 goals. The first one was to ensure that the education of the students continued in the least disruptive but yet legal way possible. The second goal was to hold accountable those people and entities who had expended both federal funds and state funds. And that's very much the focus of both ODE's investigation and the DOJ investigation. And finally, the third goal that's emerged is to identify areas of either holes in laws or practices that need to be remedied into the future. And we expect to have legislation in front of you next session around some of these areas. So the first document that I want to draw your attention to is this one-page kind of chart that's colored. What this reflects is what we believe to be the organizational structure of the Ed Choices / All Prep entity, and it also reflects the various school districts and schools that were involved with this entity back when we last spoke to you in last fall. As you can see from the chart, there are literally 8 school districts involved. There are a total of 14 schools. There were 100 employees back at the beginning of March, roughly, and there's more than 1,400 students that were originally enrolled in all of these schools. To say this is complicated is an understatement. So What we know is that all of these schools are charter schools. They all were sponsored by various school districts. In each school district, there's a charter board that managed between one and three of these schools. But all of these schools utilize the services of an entity known as ALPREP, and this entity was headed by Tim King. Now, when I say an entity is ALPREP, ALPREP doesn't really exist legally as ALPREP. It's not a nonprofit. It's just something that appears in documents. Now, each of the schools do, a lot of the schools do have the name, for example, Estacada ALPREP, Marcola ALPREP, that kind of thing. Originally, it's also that ALPREP or these schools also have relationships with an Oregon nonprofit entity known as Ed Choices. The reason there's a question mark on this chart is because I personally have not seen the contracts to back up some of the relationships that have been alleged. Some of the school districts and schools have attempted to get their hands on some of these contracts and documents, and they haven't seen them and they haven't been produced. So information around the exact relationship has continued to be developed. As we move on. The other two school districts that were involved or are involved is Paisley and Fossil. These two districts were not mentioned previously when we appeared in front of you. They have a somewhat different relationship. These school districts are single school, small districts out in eastern Oregon. They were created as bricks and mortar schools, and they entered into a contract through Mr. King with Ed Choices to have an online school or program within their larger school. So each of these schools has roughly 40 students, and so they are also very much involved and somewhat treated similarly to all of the other schools that are listed here. In the, about the middle of March, we received information from Mr. King that he had resigned his employment. And since then, I don't have any knowledge of him being associated with any of the schools that are listed on this sheet. So since March, you'll notice on here that based on the color coding, there's been a tremendous amount of activity. Since Mr. King's resignation, the administrators involved, the charter boards, previously had not had all of the information, is how I would characterize it. Many of these individuals have had to step up and piece together what was left. The administrators and teachers, like I mentioned, originally we estimate there was roughly 100. The latest estimate, there's maybe 80. There's been layoffs and resignations in these schools. Also, many teachers and administrators stepped up and took between a 20 to 30% pay cut because the financial situation of these schools is quite dire. Many administrators and teachers, even though they were laid off or they resigned or what have you, have continued to volunteer their services to these charter boards or these schools. And so I wanted to say that is just, you know, it's pretty amazing, actually, some of that. So now, as we look at these schools, there are, we started with the three schools and sisters. There were three schools. One was the Sisters Academy of Fine Arts. This had been a bricks and mortar small school focused on, I think it's kindergarten through grade three originally. It was originally established not as part of this family of schools, but separately, but Mr. King and ALPREP had taken over the management of the school in the last year and a half, so it got tied into this. And then there was also the Sisters ALPREP and Sisters Early College. All three of these schools were evicted from their facilities in Sisters in March by the landlord who had not been paid rent. And then shortly after that, the charter board for these three schools voted to close the schools. So those are now closed now, and those children have been transferred to other educational options. And the charter board out there is working on closing the nonprofit and closing the schools further. The other school, by way of example,
that illustrates actually quite a bit with the organization is you'll notice the Whole Child School listed under Sheridan. This is a school that many of you, I'm guessing, have maybe never heard of before. This came to light since we were last here. We at the department were contacted by a parent who said that she was enrolled in what she thought was a public charter school in Portland. It was a bricks and mortar school for kindergartners and first graders. There were teachers there. She, for whatever reason, started researching her school and couldn't really find a presence of it on the internet, and also found some troubling things when she started to research it, and started noticing that on the internet it was associated with Sisters in Sheridan. She had never heard these two school districts' names before, and so she contacted us. So we contacted Sisters. Sisters said that they had had some knowledge of the program, but had said that they wanted it discontinued. And then we contacted Sheridan. They had no knowledge of the program. Now, when we were able to gather the students' names and look to see which school was claiming the students for state school fund dollars, it came up that all the students were being claimed under Sheridan. Now remember, Sheridan, in their charter agreement, it did not list this program. They did not have knowledge of this program. And so then what transpired is that the landlord in Portland also evicted this school in the middle of March. The school had previously, like I said, only had maybe 10 to 12 students. It had two full-time teachers and a part-time administrator. It's also illustrative of the financial difficulties. And then those students were also transferred to other educational options, and the Sheridan All Prep is endeavoring to close the facility and that kind of thing and address those issues. So that's to give you an idea of just sort of the complexity of all of this. The other schools on here that will be closed by the end of the school year are the Marcola Early College and the Marcola All Prep schools. The Marcola Early College, and I'll get into the community college aspect of this later, effectively closed in March when it could no longer provide educational services to its students. The Marcola All Prep, both of these schools right now really don't have any financial resources and they don't have any staff. That's because they don't have any money at all. And at times, these two schools, their charter board was really not functioning. They had tried to resign. Now they are functioning. They're having meetings. And through an arrangement with the Estacada charter board, the kids that are left at the Marcola All Prep are receiving an education until the end of the year. That's about 130 kids. They're also working on giving diplomas and testing and all of that kind of thing. The charter board, though, has voted to close those two schools at the end of the year. So out of the total, 14 schools, six will be closed by the end of the year. Now, I'll get to the rest later as far as what kind of their status is. As I mentioned, there was a community college piece to this also that we were not fully aware of when we were last here. About the beginning of March, Department of Education was contacted by two different community colleges. One was Chemeketa and one was Lane. And they had both expressed to us that they had large debt that was owed by the All Prep organization, and that they're very concerned. They were asking us what could we do to apply pressure to pay that debt. What had happened was that there were roughly, four of the schools are what we call the early college schools, and those were in Estacada, Marcola, Sisters, and Baker. Those schools enrolled students, mainly juniors and seniors, and then they facilitated them enrolling in a community college in, across the state. And then the student would receive dual credit at both the community college and at the high school. There were roughly 448 early college students, but from what we can ascertain. So the first community college, like I said, to contact us was Chemeketa. And Chemeketa indicated to us that it was owed $500,000 and had not been paid for any educational services that it had provided in either the fall or the winter term. Now, to put this into perspective, each of the students, the all-prep schools were receiving roughly $5,000 a year. And based on, you know, the agreements they had entered into with the community colleges, they would have owed roughly $4,200 out of the $5,000. So the amount of state school fund dollars would have covered what they had agreed to. There was no apparent reason why the money had not been transferred to Chemeketa, to be honest. And then within about a day of that contact, we were also contacted by Lane Community College. And they indicated that they were owed about $250,000, and a similar story that they had not been paid in the fall and the winter term. At that point, I engaged the services of the Community College Association to ascertain how big was this and how many other community colleges were involved and how much were they owed. There were roughly 10 community colleges that were owed money by one or more of these schools. The two largest were Chemeketa and Lane. The smallest was owed less than $1,000, and there had been a couple of payments from some of the schools, of the smaller payments. We also started receiving phone calls from parents of students of these community college students. And, you know, and I would ask them a couple of questions, one of which was, well, did your child receive educational services? Oh, yes, we love our community college placement, that kind of thing. And then which school is your child enrolled in? You know, which of these early colleges, or, you know, because they would say all prep or that kind of thing. Often the answer was, I don't know which school. And so, but I think I got a document somewhere. And so they'd start digging, and they would literally have multiple documents indicating multiple schools. And so then, with their permission, we were able to get their names of their students, look it up again to see who was claiming, and let them know exactly which school their child was enrolled in and who, at that point, the contact people were. We also got a communication right around the middle of March from a person representing the All Prep organization. It was forwarded to us, frankly, by a parent that had been sent to all parents that indicated the organization was going to hold these parents responsible for its debt. As I'm sure you're aware, charter schools provide a free public education. They can't charge tuition. This was highly inappropriate. This raised our level of concern to a very high level. And so we met with our DOJ friends and asked them to conduct an investigation specifically into the financial aspects of both the federal charter school funds and also the state school funds. And that's, like you've been told before, is an ongoing investigation. Now, with the community colleges, what's happened is that is directly the reason why the Sisters Early College and the Marcola Early College closed, is they didn't have the money to pay the debt, in addition to the evictions and that kind of thing. With the other community colleges, the Estacada Early College has indicated to me that they've worked with their community colleges to get on a debt repayment plan that will be completed by December of this year. With Estacada, their primary community college involved was Chemeketa, which had the biggest of these debts. And they plan on continuing on, in addition to, I think it's three or four other community colleges that they've been able to arrange a repayment schedule whereby the community colleges gets paid directly from their school districts. With the Baker Early College, I know that they are working on getting a plan and rectifying the situation, but we don't have the specifics on that yet. So now, you've heard me mention about the evicted facilities. This is a theme. Over the course of March and April...
Cindy, yeah. Before you go on, can you clarify, what was the total debt to all community colleges? Do you have a rough number for that?
Yeah. I would estimate between $800,000
and $900,000. Can I ask a problem? Yes. They were getting state funding for these kids as well, right, besides that money. This is the district share to them as opposed to the... Because they were also billing for these students as enrolled students in their community college. Right?
Representative Roland, Chair Gelser, that is my understanding. Correct. correct. And the, you know, all of these schools were still getting state school funds. The Department of Ed never cut off state school funds or anything like that. So the money was coming in. You know, and the colleges, yeah, they did get money from other sources and that kind of thing, but the specific amounts owed.
Tuitions and others.
Yeah, and under the agreements that the organization had with the colleges, it was $900 a term plus $500 in books and fees and that kind of thing. So $1,400, roughly, okay. Is what was owed.
Of the approximately $5,000 they would have received for those children?
Well, $1,400 times three for three terms.
True.
And then, yeah, that's right. How you get to the $4,200 and then
right.
To the $5,000, yeah. And during the community college piece in March, there was also misinformation that went out that the Department of Education had made the decision in February to stop federal grants to three of the schools. And based on the large fiscal concerns we had, the lack of audits, and the list kind of goes on. The three schools that we stopped the grants to were not early college schools. And they should have only impacted, the stoppage of those grants should have only impacted those three schools. But the information that went out was that this community college piece was because OD had stopped funding or something like that. And so that's why I want to be really clear that we never stopped the state school fund amount, just these three federal grants. And like I said, it should not have impacted the early colleges. But the early colleges were not, or the colleges were not being paid since fall, which was way before we stopped the federal grants anyway.
Thank you. Sorry
yeah.
to interrupt you.
And it's, so now, the evicted facilities is also a theme, and there's been five facilities that have been evicted by their landlords in the last 2 months. Two in Sisters, like I said, there's one in Eugene, and then one in Portland, the whole child, and the big one is the one in Clackamas. Clackamas served as a central hub for these schools and for Ed Choices. It was roughly, it's right on Sunnyside Road, kind of right by the Clackamas Town Center, if you ever go up there. And it's about 10,000 square feet of space. There were three floors that were occupied. It also served as Mr. King's personal office. I should say also, we talked about some of the school personnel that have been so cooperative. The landlords of these facilities have also been very cooperative with us. One of the areas out there, kind of the holes in law, is that when you have an evicted facility, the landlord does not necessarily have to notify the Department of Education or the school district. They just have to notify the tenant. So with all five of these facilities, the Department of Ed found out, what I would say almost by accident. For me, it was from a newspaper reporter calling me, to be honest, with one of them. And it's also not clear, once you have an evicted facility, who owns the records necessarily, whether it's the landlord. The landlord actually has a claim to them. And there's one horror story out there, not involving these, where a landlord actually, without knowing it, sold student records. Yeah. And so when we bought them back, but eBay. So when we heard about each of these evictions going on, that our primary reaction was to secure the student records, to be honest. And so I personally contacted each landlord of each of these facilities and said, okay, you have student records, you need to keep those secure. Turn those over. I mean, that was the three messages. And like I said, the landlords have been very cooperative, and we were able to secure the records out of four of the facilities pretty quickly, with the exception of Clackamas. So I wanted to say that. Even though, I mean, these landlords, in some cases, had not been paid rent for 3 and 4 months. And while they have a facility, you know, they can't rent out their space and that kind of thing. It's kind of dire. So with the Clackamas situation, like I said, it's 10,000 square feet. We believe that there were at least 1,600 cumulative student record files at Clackamas, hard copies. There were also various other educational records with personally identifiable information about students, kind of in staff's offices, scattered about the facility, in plain view, frankly. And that was very concerning to us. A lot of the other records are very commingled amongst the schools. It is not evident where the record goes to which school. Some of the records you'll see multiple students, so it's not evident which school, you know, they belong to. When, I'll tell you, I have visited the Clackamas facility 7 times now, and when I first went in there, it was very evident that most of the staff had no idea that the eviction was coming, the lockout, because their personal effects were still there. But it was also very evident that Mr. King had full knowledge because his desk and other things were gone. Should also say that there did not appear to be any provision for the student records made to protect them, to transfer them to schools, nothing like that. So also about this time, EdChoices had an insurance policy, and that insurance company provided them with an attorney to limit their liability. So OD and DOJ did start negotiating and working with that legal counsel to gain access to the student records and those education records with personally identifiable information from the students. At times, we were denied access on previously arranged dates and that kind of thing. It's been very time-consuming and with a lot of resources put into it. Last Tuesday, we decided to take what I would characterize as a fairly aggressive action, which was to issue the order that we provided a copy to you. The reason I say it's an aggressive action is this is the first time probably that this kind of order has been issued directing a private entity like that to turn over its student records. Also on that order is a list of the various names that these schools go by. There's a lot of different names. Additionally, which made the student records up at Clackamas even more complex, is that there were 2 Washington programs with student records up there as well. And so we've also needed to work across state lines to get those records back to the Washington schools where they need to be. So once the order was issued, I can report to you, and this is not on your timeline, that Saturday morning at 8 a.m. we did take possession of the student records and all the student information that's personally identifiable, and it is being delivered to the Department of Education as I'm speaking. So, now, the goals for the student records, we have 2 primary goals immediately. As you can imagine, they're very much in disarray. Is that the first one is that a lot of the student records are also in an online program. So many students have been able to have their transcripts issued and that kind of thing throughout this process. But we've been told that there are some seniors who expect to graduate in 3 weeks that they very much need those hard copy student records. So OD's first priority to identify those seniors' records so that we can get those to the appropriate school or district or other educational option so that those kids can graduate. The second priority we have is that we also identified records around special education and federal 504 plans. We're also pulling those out and identifying those so that they can also get to the requisite schools that they need to go. Beyond that, our goal is that by September to have all of those records gone from the Department of Education and out to the appropriate educational placement where the student will be. Also to tell you, we've also set up protocols at the department whereby there's really only 2 people who have access to the student records that are handling the administration of the records. And I can tell you that even myself and Mr. Allen here are not 2 of those people because, you know, student records are a very serious thing. They should be held confidential and only those staff that need to, you know, should have access. We're also working, frankly, on cleaning up the records, placing, those miscellaneous documents in the appropriate files, identifying records to a particular school. In one case, for example, a record had 2 different students in one file. We're working to, sort that out. The records also did not have what we would normally expect to see for a school, such things as the school's name, teachers, principals, that kind of thing. So we're working to do that. Now, moving forward, with the remaining schools, I think Morgan said that these schools and districts and so forth have been very forthcoming, and I hope you've gotten the sense that they've really had a really big challenge in front of them. What we have been doing is we've been meeting with each of the individual schools who wish to continue to give technical assistance, guidance, information, that kind of thing. These meetings have roughly been between 3 and 4 hours. to sort out the particular school's issues. What's been going on with these schools is that they've been amending their charter agreements because they're finding they're not sufficient. There's some problems with them, that kind of thing. So they're working with their individual districts to do that. And these schools have also have been working to separate themselves from each other, which has also been very challenging, as you can imagine. But in doing that, like I said, they've had to amend charters and so forth. They've been working to cancel and provide notices of termination to certain programs that they had no knowledge were operating under their schools, such as the Whole Child program. Village Home is another one that they are working to terminate and that kind of thing. They had to redo their budgets, you know, identifying money coming in, appropriate staff that are going to be staying, you know, key staff members, that kind of thing. They've been paying off and identifying the debt. And finally, the other key piece of this is they've been communicating to parents. Many of these schools have had multiple communications out to the parents to say, your child is enrolled in our school, this is what we're doing. And, you know, and that's not without consequences. Many of these parents, as you can imagine, are very angry, very troubled that suddenly they're learning. And I had received communication last week from a parent who learned that her child was enrolled in Sheridan and she had worked to get them into Estacada and was like, why did this happen, you know? And so some of these communications, I mean, they get kind of a firestorm coming back at them, to be honest. And I think what Morgan mentioned around Orvin, Orca, and some of our other educational providers is that as some of these schools closed, literally in the middle of the school year, the students had, in some cases, really kind of limited options about where to go, is that those other educational providers have opened their doors and, you know, to the largest extent allowed under their policies and law and that kind of thing, and really accepted in these kids. So with that, do you have any questions?
Before we get to the questions, I understand that you continue to have an investigation,
yes.
That the Department of Justice continues to have an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
I know we all had many questions following the last hearing, which is why I brought folks back today. I understand that some of your answers to our questions may be that you cannot answer the questions. I also wanted the committee to know that we made efforts to invite others who were involved in this to participate in the hearing, to provide another side of the story. You may not be surprised. A lot of folks were not interested in having that conversation. We do have someone here from the Marcola School District that I want to make sure we give a couple of minutes, so we may run a few minutes past our 10:30 timeline. I have one question, and then Representative Van Orman. I received a letter, and other members of this committee may have, from a family that we worked with in February when we passed House Bill, whatever that number was, that basically said if there's an arrangement with a third-party entity, that the financial relationship is between those two entities, rather than having the parent pay up front and then the parent wait to get reimbursement later. So what I had heard from this family was that they had paid their $500 up front. They were waiting for reimbursement for that, as they had been promised, and they are now learning that there's no money and therefore they won't be reimbursed. What recourse do they have to get reimbursed for paying out for public education services?
Right. Chair Gelser, thank you for bringing that up. Let me address that. That was the Village Home program specifically. And originally it was thought that it was likely only maybe one or two of the schools that had a relationship with Village Home. But in fact, it's more like eight or nine. And the amount of money possibly owes varies from like $250 at Sisters up to $60,000 at Estacada. And
not to individual families,
no,
to Village
no,
Home itself.
Total, yeah. And remember, most of these schools had no knowledge of this relationship. And so... So now, you know, they've been approached by parents and others saying, you know, you owe us money. Now, this is a theme that they're going through right now with various people approaching them. And so some of these schools have said, well, wait a minute, where's the contract, where's the policy, you know, that this is under? They're trying to ascertain, you know, is this a debt, is this, you know, and that kind of thing. There's been none produced. Now, some of the schools, like I said, they're now operating independently, is that some of the schools have decided that, yes, in fact, they're paying the amounts, and they have made a payment to Village Home, which has then distributed the money to the parents that were in that particular school. Estacada, for example, has reported that to me. Other schools are still looking at the situation to ascertain, you know, are these, you know, and confirm, are these students our students? You know, is this debt, okay, is this really the debt, and that kind of thing. Each of the schools right now are working on that. I don't necessarily know for sure how many of the schools will not pay any of it. If I had to hazard a guess, I would question the Sisters and Marcola schools, because they're the ones that have basically no money. And so I know that that is very frustrating, you know, for the parents, because up until this point they've been treated as a group. And so some of the parents are getting paid and some haven't been. But, you know, when we look at our chart, the two most surprising to me that were involved with the Village Home situation were Paisley and Fossil. They, like I said, had no knowledge of this. They thought they were signing up for an online program. So they are, you know, very much looking at this situation, trying to ascertain the situation.
Cindy, can I clarify what that would mean? Is not that there were students that were living in Paisley or Fossil were driving all the way to Village Home to get services.
No.
It would be students that were living in the Beaverton area who signed up in that area, but rather than enrolling in a school in their area, it turned out that without their knowledge or the knowledge of the other district, they were signed up in Paisley or Fossil.
Sure, Gelser, yeah, you're correct. You're correct. And Fossil and Paisley have their own charter schools, and they, like I said, had a direct contract with Ed Choices for providing educational services. So they're working on that. And at least one of them, Fossil, has indicated that they will not be continuing that particular education agreement going forward to the next year. They're looking at other options for providing online services to their students.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. In all of this, and after our meeting in February, I have been a bit anxious, and it seems that, again, it's a contractual oversight problem. And it's my assumption that because the school district permits this charter school, the school district has the responsibility for oversight on that contract. Is that correct?
Representative Van Orman, Chair Gelser, that is correct. The school district definitely has a responsibility for oversight on that contract.
And so when,
follow-up.
And so when there are problems, it should be the school district that's resolving them, but this has gotten beyond the school district at this point.
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, we're working in conjunction with the school districts to resolve many of these problems.
Okay.
But the issue is that, you know, when we started, each of us probably had only a piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And each school district probably continues to only have a piece of the puzzle. And because they were so commingled, both in their records, their funds, their employees, everything, no one school district has the ability to, you know, rectify all of the problems associated with its particular school. Like, no one school district could have stepped in, for example, to the Clackamas facility and gotten the records, just as an example. So that's why, although the school districts are still very much responsible for monitoring those contracts and moving, you know, and ensuring these schools move forward in a legal way that provide services and all that kind of thing. That's one of the reasons that the Department of Education has stepped in to a greater extent than what we originally thought we would need to.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Van Orman's question, these were all, regardless of what they were called, these are all charter schools that had agreements with school districts. And I can think of an instance a few years ago where a particular school district received a letter from ODE saying if this charter school, a bricks and mortar, very traditional charter school serving kids very well, had one little I or T not crossed or dotted, and the ODE sent a letter to the school district saying if that T doesn't get crossed, you're going to lose your funding because that's how the funding moves through. And that was taken care of and resolved, and it was an appropriate issue to address. How I'm seeing a great disparity between that instance and such a mess that a flowchart makes it difficult to understand
What was, I have some concerns with the school district in there, and I have some concerns with ODE mm-hmm. playing in this role, that we got to this point, that this flow chart is, by your own admission, is probably pretty correct. How do we have that disparity?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Representative Springer and Chair Gelser. It's that, you know, up until roughly the beginning of January, the kind of information we had gotten on these schools, we hadn't received information necessarily that there had been illegalities. There had been some practices that we questioned, frankly, but they weren't illegal practices. When we had gotten some information about some issues, we spoke to Mr. King directly and asked him directly, you know, are you doing this? You know you cannot do this under the law, which we do to all the schools, frankly, before getting to the point of the letter. When we did get information that was very specific to the illegalities, we issued the January letter to the school districts. And at that point, though, one of the things that made this very difficult in regards, as compared to other charter schools, is that they were so mixed up with each other. So to issue, you know, normally we would issue a letter to one school district and say, your school has this problem. Please look into this. But it's difficult in this situation to issue that kind of letter because the problem exists in your neighbor district and that kind of thing. But to say that was definitely one of the objectives of the January letter was to put the districts on notice. It did mention the withholding of state school fund dollars in the January letter. If the problems had continued without the districts addressing the issues, everything's happened pretty quickly. We would have been looking at the withholding of state school fund dollars, definitely. And I'm not saying that that's off the table still, but what I can say is that, I guess that's further back on the table, because the school districts and the schools, with the resignation of Mr. King, to be frank, have very much stepped up and very much tried to rectify the problems and address the issues. If we didn't see that happening, we would still be looking at very much the withholding of state school fund dollars.
Thank you. May I follow up?
Please
follow up, and I'll put you back on the queue.
And I guess I just want to add to that ever so briefly. With charter schools, and I sat on a school board that had a charter agreement, yeah. We had a great deal of responsibility as a school board. So we have six districts, maybe eight districts here, I guess, that have a role in this. I'm not saying it's their fault at all. It's not. But they have a contractual agreement here and a contractual responsibility also in this. I think that's key to draw out here.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
And that's my question. When you told us that this whole child school that was up in the Portland area, they didn't apparently have a contract with Sheridan School District, but because Sheridan didn't know they existed. But they were part of all prep. So were the kids who you found in Sheridan who were being, your money was going through, were they coming to that, were they getting those names through all prep, the Sheridan all prep, or how did they get the names?
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin, I believe all those kids lived in the Portland area because it was a bricks and mortar school. As far as where did they get the names for those kids and how did they direct them there, I'm not sure. I can share with you this, is that we received in March two emails within 12 hours of each other. The first email, this is when the whole child program, people were starting to ask questions. And so the first email was sent to the parents, and it basically said that the whole child program was specifically a program of the Sheridan School. You know, parents, it's okay, it's a program of the Sheridan School kind of a thing. The second email that was sent to Sheridan said, oh, no, this program isn't your program. You know, it's a program of all these schools. Like I said, they were within 12 hours from administrators, you know, in this, you know, one was Mr. King, to be honest, who sent this. And so, you know, if the whole child program had continued, that would be something that we would look at and say, you know, that is an illegal program. It is a school operating within a school. It is outside of the sponsor school district. These parents have no knowledge. I mean, the list goes on. But because now it's closed, it's, you know, and Sheridan did take steps, you know, to hold them accountable, to continue to reach out to those parents, to continue to rectify the situation with the landlord, to really look at its charter agreement moving forward. The other thing about Sheridan is, you'll notice it's kind of a pale blue on here, Sheridan did serve a notice of termination on its school in April. One of the reasons was the whole child program at that point. And although they're very much working together to rectify the situation and to address, you know, the issues identified in that notice of termination, and after meeting with them, you know, there is a possibility that the school will continue on even though it did receive a notice of termination from its district.
And Cindy, can you clarify? You told me this on the phone. These schools started, they opened when? What is that?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's the other thing to keep in mind with all this is all of these schools opened in the last 2 years or became involved with All Prep in the last 2 years. And at least three of the schools opened last fall. Sheridan, for example, opened last fall. They found themselves in this situation within 5 months of opening. That's how quickly this transpired. So when we talk about, you know, the responsibility, indefinitely, there's a responsibility there. But when I've spoken to some of these superintendents and school districts and so forth, they did start to ask questions, you know, which is kind of the first step. You know, let's ask questions. Let's get these agreements. The agreements weren't forthcoming. You know, a lot of times the information was withheld. And so within a very relatively short amount of time, the districts and schools found themselves in this situation.
Thank you. Representative Dembrough.
Just quickly, Madam Chair, Cindy, you mentioned at the beginning, or Morgan, someone mentioned that you'll probably be coming to us with some proposed legislation.
Yeah.
And is there anything that we should be sort of chewing over in our minds right now about this, you know, as we're looking forward?
Yeah, well, Chair Gelser, Representative Dembrough, the student records piece is the one of the biggest pieces for me, just personally, because, you know, around, you know, the having the notices going out to from these private landlords to ODE and their local school districts, the reason being is that we're seeing more and more schools, whether they're charter schools or otherwise, renting from private landlords that have no idea the importance of the student records. So that's one piece that we're working on. Also the piece around very clearly stating that, you know, these student records are really the property of, you know, their school, their district, ODE, whatever, because that's been a piece that we've seen not just in the charter school realm, but we've also seen it in a couple of other situations. So that's definitely one of the pieces. Another piece that's been brought up, and I'm also working with the Oregon School Board Association on a 10-year review of charter law, and we've been discussing a lot of things around this, but one piece that's come up through that is the independent nature of the charter boards. Some of these charter boards were not necessarily what we would characterize as independent, and so that's a piece that we're definitely, you know, looking at, and, you know, because that was a piece that, you know, just did not exist. So there's a couple of pieces, and, you know, and frankly, I'm afraid I'm being maybe somewhat vague, but because there's been so much with this, our focus has been up until this point, you know, getting the records, making sure the kids are still in school, making sure they graduate, they're tested, you know, and now we're starting to focus more on other issues.
And now we have a couple of more questions and one more person, and we are 10 minutes behind schedule. So, Representative Comp.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. Cindy Hunt, thank you. What you took on is an enormous task, and Arnie and I can talk about what it's like to sit in a principal's chair and be responsible for student records. The student records issue here is paramount. You have 1,400 students that you're taking care of as like a principal, and I don't know if their parents appreciate the work that you're doing, but when they go and look for those transcripts, when they apply to their universities, when individual schools sit there and figure out who's going to be their valedictorian and who's not, and because those grades, each and every one of them, matter, and you're taking care of our children to the level that is above and beyond. So, thank you. And the other thing that I would point out is that we have been skirting around the topic of online education in this state for several years now, and we have parents that have these 1,400 students out there seeking some sort of academic support for their child and accepting these unknowns. I think it's time to be bringing that topic to a full conversation in our state.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Well, basically, I think Cindy has answered it, but really, for me, again, it comes down to contractual oversight and how can we tighten that up, because a lot of people have been vulnerable in this, not just the children, but the school districts, and so I am concerned about contractual oversight.
Thank you. And Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, Cindy, you were just talking a couple minutes ago about the independent boards.
Yeah.
Independent of each other.
Yeah, referencing there.
Mm-hmm. Representative Springer and Chair Gelser, most of the time when a charter school is created, it has a nonprofit board that oversees it, and nonprofit laws apply to the boards and that kind of thing. But there aren't really any laws that say, you know, for example, that an employee can't be on a board, or that someone can't serve on multiple boards, or that you have to have a particular, you're supposed to have five, but in many of these schools' instances, there were three because of resignations. Also, I think we'll be more fully addressing what these boards look like later when we get a full investigatory report, because there's been some allegations just around different people serving and that kind of thing. So that's part of it. I mean, when I say independent, you know, there were shared people, I believe, from board to board to board within this. Yeah, now, but I should say, too, is that those schools that want to survive, they have made an effort also to bolster their boards in the last month or so. They've been recruiting community members to serve on the board that are independent of the situation, that bring their own expertises and that kind of thing. They've been working to expand their boards. This is something that kind of universally they've recognized is this is an area they need to address and improve, and have had success with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing all of this information forward, and thank you for jumping quickly in January to bring this issue to the attention of districts and acting quickly now. I know from a conversation I had with you at the end of the week that you spent your Saturday personally obtaining those records so that kids can graduate this spring, and I doubt that those students will know that they are walking across the stage in a few weeks because that's how you spent your Saturday, but on their behalf, I thank you.
And next we have Joel Bradford, the superintendent of the Marcola School District. Welcome. Thank you for coming, and I apologize in advance for the brevity of your visit with us.
Yes. That's okay. I've got a meeting at 11 o'clock coming up. My name is Joel Bradford. I'm the interim superintendent at Marcola School District. I took over that position in the middle of August this year, and worked with the Marcola School District the previous year. I have a meeting at 11 o'clock with Michael Welpong with respect to some of the issues that we discussed, in particular the possibility of any additional funding to be passed through to the school boards for the all-prep program at this point. And we'll be looking at that. I didn't come with any kind of a prepared statement. I've learned an awful lot within a short period of time. I agree with the statements that were made up here with respect to the oversight, in particular, that a school district has with respect to virtual charter schools, or any charter school for that matter. What I found myself is that it is extremely difficult when you're looking at a charter school that operates without a brick and mortar location in particular, or you're trying to get a handle on some of those things. And this issue is extremely complex, and its complexity has done nothing but astound me since I started looking into it in January at the request of ODE. And with respect to that, Chair Gelser and committee members, I'm willing to take any questions that I think I can answer at this point, given some of the opening statements by the Department of Justice.
And thank you very much for taking the time to come and putting your efforts and attention on this complicated issue. Are there questions for the superintendent?
Just briefly.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't know if you've even seen the flowchart that we're looking at here. So the two schools, Marcola Early College and Marcola All Prep, are green, which means closed end of the year. So are they functioning now? Are they closing in a couple weeks? Where really are you in that process?
That's a good question, Chair Gelzer and Representative Springer. The schools for Marcola fall into two categories. The early college, after we were given notice by LCC that the payments were not made, basically ended at the end of the winter term for LCC, and there are no students in particular that are in that school at this point. The second program, the all-prep program, almost went into a state of limbo. We've been able to work with ODE and the representatives from Estacada to try to provide some educational services for these students to be able to continue to the end of the year, which is, again, part of my meeting at 11 o'clock. And the two schools, our district school board voted to provide letters of termination back in April, or was it March? I'm trying to remember which one. But we set the date for June 21st for termination. However, the board reformed for the two all-prep programs and voted to close the schools at the end of the year. Hope that answered your question.
Thank you. Any final questions, Representative Van Orman?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I'm not sure if this is a question for you, but basically, now that Tim King has resigned, who is the individual responsible for the organization?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, I couldn't begin to answer that.
Thank you. And that's a question I've asked previously, and it's I think it's an answer that is unclear at this point in time. Cindy, do you want to come back up for that?
Cindy Hunt again. When you say the organization, there's, you know, kind of two organizations. You know, there's the Ed Choices organization and the, quote, all-prep organization. The all-prep organization is basically kind of dissolved, and these schools are very much working to be very separate entities. So when we talk about who's responsible, it is the board chairs and the principals of each of those schools. Ed Choices they still have, I think it's a two-person board and a president and a couple of employees, but, you know, they, like I said, I can't speak to their plans, but, you know, they were working on clearing out a 10,000-square-foot facility. I'm not sure that they will be moving forward as an entity.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Representative Maurer.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Does Mr. King hold any personal liability? Civil and criminal?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, that's one of those questions that I'm not going to answer at this time because of the ongoing DOJ investigation and OD investigation. I can say that we are exploring all options.
Follow up. I mean, you've given us a lot of details that I quite frankly think were maybe part of the investigation. And so, I mean, that's a simple statement that they either have it, responsibility, or they don't have responsibility. So it's in the statute or it's not in the statute. So, I mean, can you give us, I mean, is it clearly in the statute or is it ambiguous?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, one of the difficulties in this, and I know I have given you a lot of information, but there's actually a whole other aspect of this that we're happy to come back and talk to you about that's very much at the center of the investigation. Believe it or not, there's even more. But as far as the liability goes, one of the difficulties is in unraveling this because it's not exactly clear under whose authority he was operating. It's also not exactly clear when you start to look at the contracts. They're under different entities' names. They're under his name. It just varies, getting those documents. I haven't seen all those documents. We're talking about thousands of documents. So that's why it's not exactly a clear answer at this point. Okay. I am confident, though, that at the conclusion of the ODE and the DOJ investigation, we will have a very clear answer to that.
Okay.
Thanks. And a quick follow-up to that, and then we really do need to move on to our next topic. My understanding is that there were some of these schools in Washington and that Mr. King may be working to develop another one of these organizations in Washington. Is there any communication between the Department of Ed, local school districts, and districts in the state of Washington and the Washington Department of Education?
Yes, Chair Gelser, you are correct. He did have a relationship with two school districts in Washington. They don't have a charter law up there, so it's a different, it's more akin to our alternative education program with the contract.
one of the school districts did call me and ask for information. I provided the information that we had, and then they canceled and terminated their contract. The second school district I've also been in a lot of communications with because their student records were at the Clackamas facility, and frankly, I think that I have some more of their student records. And so they are looking at his activities, and we will be sharing information across state lines, you know, with those school districts, our counterparts in their Department of Education, Department of Justice, that kind of thing. And so, you know, yes, he has an online site that he's attempting to recruit more students and that kind of thing that I can tell you, but I don't think I can speak to, you know, going out into the future about Washington.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for coming. Obviously, this is a continuing, unfolding situation. I'm sure we'll have another update later, and we'll be working closely with the department, hopefully in September, to have ready for our drafting requests for the legislation that we may need, particularly around student records and making sure that we're taking good care of student records. So we're going to move on from that exciting topic, and thank you all very much. And now we're going to have a very, very brief update on virtual schools from Duncan Wise, who's the chair of the State Board of Education. You all may remember that we've had some brief discussions in this building around the governance structure for online charter schools. Again, wholly separate from the discussion that we have just had. Put a big barrier in your mind between that discussion and this one. As we talked in February, there was concern about this history of virtual school governance bouncing back and forth between the Department of Ed and, or the State Board of Education and the legislature. We really want to put a bow tie on this thing and get it done. So we brought Mr. Weiss in an effort to keep the lines of communication open. Senator Devlin and I are also regularly meeting with Mr. Weiss. Their recommendations are due to us by September 1st, and it's all in an effort to keep this rolling. So, Mr. Weiss, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I really appreciate the invitation to be before you to talk about a very complicated and important topic, the future of governance of online learning. My name is Duncan Weiss. I'm chair of the State Board of Education, and we are responding to the legislation you passed in February 3660, which asked the board to propose to you a governance model for online learning. As the chair mentioned, this has had quite a lot of history. The board has dealt with this issue over the last three years or so, and made a number of decisions related to virtual online learning, and, as you know, produced a report in February of 2009 that gave a structure and a concept for how to proceed with this issue. What I'd like to do very briefly today is just give you a quick update, and then, above all, I'd love to hear any reflections you have. We do see this report as a partnership. You've asked us as a board to give us recommendations on governance, and again, really want to make sure all the lines are open for dialogue with you. This is a very complex issue. First of all, a little bit of context. As you know, virtual learning is coming, and I believe it's going to be ever more important for education in Oregon. We've seen this a lot through the lens of full-time virtual learning, and you've heard a lot about that. I actually, that's really important. I actually think what's even more important is going to be the supplemental or part-time virtual learning, which I think is going to come, and as we suggest in our report, be an extremely large part of the educational experience over the next decade. So this is a very important topic, and a whole series of issues arise as we think about governance and delivery. Fundamentally, what's different about this is as a teacher in one part of the state can be teaching a student in another part of the state, and it really creates a different set of issues in terms of the relationship between the student and the education provider that, frankly, crosses the traditional boundaries of school districts. And so it is, in some sense, a disruptive force. It's also a very positive force in terms of providing options for students, and we have a series of challenges we need to think through as we come up with a governance model for virtual full-time learning. As a board, I can tell you we are not one voice on this. We, like you, have a whole series of perspectives. Representative Dembro is our board advisor. We'll recall very clearly as we struggle with these issues. I think, like you, we have a whole series of different points of view, and like you, our ultimate value is how do we provide the best education experience at the most effective cost for our students in Oregon, and how do we make sure that every student gets a really good experience and that we have strong accountability for those providing those services. So I think we have a fundamental perspective, but we also see all the variation and set of issues associated with this. At the core of what we're dealing with are some questions. Who can provide online learning in Oregon? Who are the providers that should be able to make those services available? Who can take courses? Under what conditions? What is the role of the student's home district in deciding what courses are available? What is the role of the parent of the student in making those choices? How do we assure equality across the state? And how do we make sure we're getting the best value for our dollars, the public dollars that are used? What is the funding arrangement for providing those services? These are very difficult, challenging questions, and again, a lot of different perspectives we're hearing as we go through this work. In terms of our process, the board made a decision early on that we wanted to stay actively engaged with this issue. The board is hearing this on this topic at every meeting through our board retreat in August. Next meeting, I expect we'll have about 4 hours on the docket for this topic. Jan McComb, our board advisor, has been leading for us on staff. She's been pulling the ODE staff together, looking at some of the topics you've asked us to address, including finance, special ed, and a whole series of other issues. We've had a first meeting of a work group that bringing the parties together to share their perspectives. We're going to have another meeting next week, and a couple of the board members at least will be at that. The parties have all said that they want to try to work together and see if we can find ways to where the common ground exists, and if we can find that, we will certainly try to do so. In the end, though, of course, the decision will be the board's. Our recommendations will come from the board, but we are really eager to hear the points of view of the parties. I would tell you, with all the work that's gone on both in the legislature and before the board, the parties are a lot more sophisticated today. I think we have all learned together about this, and I think the issues are coming together. But again, there are still some very thorny issues to be worked out. So again, we will have an extended discussion at the board meeting in June, and we'll draft a report. We'll bring it back to our board for the retreat in August, and we expect to have a report for you in September. With that, I know this is a general overview. There's a lot involved here. Madam Chair, I'm not sure how much you said you want me to just introduce it today, and I'd be happy. I would love to hear any perspectives or any questions you have. This is obviously a very complex issue, but again, I'm more than happy to share now or at your convenience our perspectives on this important issue.
And thank you for that overview. We have about 2 minutes for discussion here before we go on to the next thing. So comments, and before we get to those comments, if committee members who've been very engaged in this issue, and obviously mm-hmm. any recommendations you make, those recommendations of the decision of the board, for us to pass them into legislation, it becomes the decision of the committee and the
right.
legislature as
sure.
a whole, which is why we're wanting to
right.
keep this close loop of communication. Where should members who are particularly interested in this issue be directing their concerns, ideas, and cautions and suggestions too?
In this case, this is so important. Certainly to Jan, but I'd be happy to have a conversation with any of you, and I know my fellow board members would feel the same. So if any board member you're feeling comfortable talking with, I will certainly be happy to talk with you about this. I consider this, and just to stress, the future, this is a big deal to the future of Oregon education. Virtual online learning is going to be a major force in Oregon education over the next decade, and we need to get this right. So we, as a board, are taking this extremely seriously, and I'm really pleased the partnership we have with you. We want to work with you, and we need to be in this together. And so, again, feel free to call me or board members or Jan. We want to be engaged with you.
Thank you. Representative Comp?
Thank you. I read a lot about this subject, but I would share, I don't know if colleagues got this in their mail, Ed Week did a supplement on this issue, and the articles are excellent. It's April 28th,
Great.
2010. And, I would encourage you. One research institute, and it didn't come from this document, has stated within the last month that they believe by 2025 that 40% of all high school classes will be online. And I just choked on that one. But anyway, those are the things that are coming around about this subject, and the sooner we get on a good path with it, probably the better off we are.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Any final comments or questions?
Just a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Duncan, can you tell us what the status is of the Oregon Virtual School District and how that fits into, mm-hmm. you know, the work that the board is doing?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, the Oregon Virtual School is housed, of course, at ODE. What it has available are a series of online courses, essentially the software for the courses that they have contracted and is available to school districts throughout the state. So a teacher can come, take a program from the virtual school district and use it in curriculum development for that teacher. I would stress that's part of the equation, but a software program is not a virtual course. A virtual course is the combination of a software program and a teacher. And the real issue we're struggling with is who teaches which students under what conditions. And so it's part of it, but again, I don't want to suggest it's all. The fundamental issue is who puts the full program together. And my own take on this is there are going to be a whole lot of mixing and matching, and this is all going to evolve in very interesting ways in the years ahead. But it's part of it, but not all of it.
Thank you very much, Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, because I agree with you, and I think that the biggest growth will be in the individual course mm-hmm. sections that kids get to take all over the state. And it's the only way to get the playing field even for kids across the state, wherever they live, that they can have the opportunity. And it shouldn't be anything to do with virtual school, with charter schools. It should be an Oregon program that gets developed by you guys and is available to all Oregon kids through their school districts. And so working that out, I agree with you, single most important thing. We'll figure out the charter school virtual stuff.
Right.
But that one is more important for more kids and more opportunities to allow kids in diverse parts of Oregon to get the education they need. And I commend what you're doing, because I think you're having thoughtful discussions. I wish we could have gotten there sooner, but at the same time, and I also believe it really has to be something that's done at the state level. I don't think individual districts should be expected to handle that for the rest of the state. So somehow, anything I can do, and I commend all the work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So our next stop on our journey today is an overview of professional science master's degrees. We have Ursula Becker here, who's the director of off-campus science programs at Oregon State University. Both of our last two presentations are done by constituents of mine. And she also has Bruce Schaefer, also from the Oregon University system. I would particularly like to thank Dr. Beckert for coming today. I understand that there was a fairly significant accident recently, and that demonstrates significant commitment to this cause, to be willing to come today rather than delaying till September. So thank you for making the effort to come.
Thank you. I guess you can take that as a sign of my passion for what I'm talking about. Why is everybody leaving right now when I'm
So sometimes what happens, I know this is your first time here, sometimes people come in to the room to hear certain parts, and so you get a different audience for different pieces. And at different points, sometimes people get up, and we're now 3 hours into the meeting, so someone may get up and walk to the restroom and come back. Don't worry, it won't be anything that you have said.
The people who are here are the creme de la creme.
We're hoping our members will come back.
That's right. And if you would start your presentation by introducing yourself with your name for the record, and then when you start speaking as well, if you can do the same, you can wait until you start your comments. But that's important for both the record, and then this is being broadcast live over the Internet, so people that are listening in remote locations will also want to know who you are.
Okay. I'm Ursula Beckert. I'm Director of Off-Campus Programs for the College of Science at Oregon State University.
I'm Bruce Schaefer, Director of Industry Affairs with the Oregon University System. I'm going to let Ursula do the talking, and maybe I'll answer a question at the end.
Thank you very much.
And please, you should have a packet of information in front of you. I made a copy of the PowerPoint presentation. There's some interesting information there that I thought you might want to have for the record. And then there's also three recent articles about professional science master's programs, so you have some reading material. And I know some of you, like Representative Comp and Representative Gelsler, are familiar with PSM programs already, but I'm going to give a broad overview today about professional science master's programs and why we're interested in developing them in Oregon. I've been working with Bruce Schaefer for, is it 3 years now?
Not quite, but almost. Maybe that much work.
Yeah, that much work for sure. On developing a statewide PSM program, and it's been great working with him. I think we've accomplished a lot in the time that we've been here. Are we able to dim the lights at all near where the slides are so that...
I'm doing that now.
Okay, great, thank you. So I'm going to briefly talk about what a Professional Science Master's or PSM program is, why we're interested in these new options, what's happening nationally, and then what's happening in our state. So a Professional Science Master's is typically 2 years of graduate level education in science, and then these students receive additional training in business management, communication, ethics, and professional skills. They also complete an internship in lieu of thesis research, so it has an applied component. And these are primarily graduate degrees for non-academic positions. So that, in a nutshell, is what a PSM program is. This slide is going to talk a little bit about why we are interested in these PSM programs. The axis on the left is science and engineering PhDs conferred by number from 1975 to 2005. And this information came from the National Science Board. So this is the number of PhDs that were conferred in the USA. Here's the number conferred in the UK and Germany. There's what's happening in Asia. Some of you may be familiar with that. But what is of interest is the percent of U.S. citizens who are earning those PhDs. And that is disappointing. You can see that in 2005 it was below 55%. Similarly, master's degrees in sciences earned over the past 20 years, from 1980 to 2002, have also declined almost in half. So the reason we are interested in PSM programs is to revitalize the career potential for students who don't want to pursue the longer doctorate. Employers do need PhDs, but not that many. Versatile graduate degrees that contribute to a robust economy is what PSMs are all about.
Madam
and the
Chair?
Majority... Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm a little slow on the uptake. Back on the graph, mm-hmm. The percentage of U.S. student of U.S. citizens who of all of the PhD level that are being conferred in the U.S. or
I believe it's the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're okay. So as an essentially, it's the number of Asian students that are entering, being matriculated into our programs is increasing, and the number
that's likely playing into
U.S. students are actually doesn't appear to be decreasing.
I think to result in a precipitous decline, it's a combination of fewer U.S. citizens earning PhDs plus a proportional increase of international students. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the U.S. That's just in the U.S.
The last question is, how many are coming from China and India specifically? Is that the bulk of them?
I don't have it broken down, but have this slide, and you might be able to find this online.
Okay, thank you.
And delve more into it. So my last point on this slide was that the majority of new jobs are being created in the non-academic sector. So the next few slides, I want to talk about why a new science master, specifically the PSM, from the industry, university, and student perspective. Industry is interested in really bridging the gap in communication between science and business. Often those are viewed as two separate arms, you know, the marketing and the research. And these students can bridge both worlds. Also, a majority of master's holders remain in the state as opposed to PhD holders. So when we say we're contributing to the economy, we do have some information to back that claim. And then people in the workforce hiring these students, they like these degrees to be industry responsive. So in other words, we really have to work with them when we develop these programs and the curricula. The graduate degrees should be focused. They really like the internship requirement. And also, because we're creating these partnerships off campus, there's opportunities for financial and intellectual partnerships. From the university perspective, there's a commitment to outreach serving the needs of the state. There's also an interest in rejuvenating an interest in science among the U.S. citizens. There's a growing convergence of academic and professional fields. And by leveraging partnerships off campus, that's financially beneficial as well. And then there are also new models of graduate education emerging, different consortia, multi-institutional programs, and these programs are very conducive for those kinds of new models. From the students' perspective, they're interested in broadening their career options. With those additional skills that they're acquiring, they often have more opportunities in their chosen career or to bridge into other ones. And also in science, it's interesting. Often a master's is viewed as a stepping stone to a PhD. So a student earning a master's, often they get asked, why didn't you earn a PhD? And if someone earns an MBA, usually they don't get a question about why didn't you get a PhD in business administration. But in science, that's not true. So this is an effort to try and develop a more respectable master's science degree. There are lots of interdisciplinary training opportunities because these PSM programs often develop in emerging fields in interdisciplinary programs. There are also good graduate level reentry programs for students out in the workforce. They are master's degrees, so they're a bit shorter than the long-term financial and time commitment of PhDs. And there are also more online options coming up, and that was what the last talk was about, and I have to agree with that too. And finally, there's hands-on learning opportunities. Students really like that, so they really like that internship component of the degree. And our graduates primarily work in non-academic sectors. They're very much team-oriented environments. They quickly advance through into the managerial levels in organizations where they work because of that additional training. So really, it's a win-win-win for university students and the employers that hire these individuals. The National Professional Science Masters Association last year did a survey of the alumni. They had 281 respondents. Over half of them graduated from programs in life sciences. The majority worked in industry positions after graduation, and the remainder in academia, nonprofit, and government agencies. What's interesting is that over half of them worked for companies employing over 1,000 people, so large companies. The next largest group worked for companies with only 1 to 25 employees, in other words, startups. And when you think about the education that these students are getting, it makes a lot of sense. They're very versatile and tend to have entrepreneurial tendencies. The median annual salary is pretty respectable as well. And the 19% that were earning more than $90,000 were primarily in the biotech industry. The National Academy of Sciences in 2008 came out with a report. If you're interested, I do have some extra copies of this report. You can also download it online. But they started out by looking at master's programs in general, and it became a great marketing booklet on PSM programs, actually. Very strong endorsement from the Academy, encouraging employers, universities, state governments, everybody to invest and develop more of these programs. To give you an idea of the nuts and bolts of what a program like this is like, at OSU we have 30 credits of core science curriculum, we have 6 credits of internship, and then 18 credits of professional curriculum. So this is a 54 degree credit program.
as opposed to 45 for traditional masters. So often these degrees are called science plus. So because we add the additional training does not mean that they receive less training in science. And I think that's important to point out. So they have a full year of business, starting with accounting and finance, moving into project management and marketing, and then innovation management, where they write their own business plan, pulling everything together. Communication is very important. Every industry person I ever talked to said we'd really value that. Research ethics, if you're combining science and business, that's important. And then professional skills is where they work with an off-campus company on a project as a team. It's a spring term project. They've had all of their training over the year. So again, it's integrating all of that knowledge in a practical way. This is where PSM programs exist in the U.S. There's almost 200 programs at almost 100 universities. So you can see that we're the Lone Star State up in Oregon, but that won't be that way for long. Lots of different types of programs. There's a national website at sciencemasters.com. You can get a lot of information there. And what's happening now is these other little bullet points is where there are statewide initiatives. So whole university systems or other statewide efforts to facilitate development of these programs, and you'll see that Oregon is one of those. So at OSU right now we have four programs. The way that we started the Oregon PSM initiative is through the National Governors Association. They had a policy academy on state strategies to meet emerging workforce needs through PSMs. That's where I first met Bruce. And then we subsequently received a planning grant and an implementation grant in 2008 and 2009 from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. And we also received some support from the Chancellor's Office to launch the statewide initiative. These are some of the members of our team that we've been working with to move forward. And we initially wanted to explore what is a PSM, why would we want to do it in Oregon, would this really serve the needs of the state? So we didn't just launch into this without any knowledge. We contracted with the Oregon Employment Department. They conducted a survey of industry in Oregon. And when asked, I'm just going to show briefly a few of the results of the survey. When asked what skills and credentials and experiences do you value the most, work experience and communication were very high on the list. And that wasn't really a surprise. Almost half of them said that they would make internships available. 43% said they'd be likely to hire graduates. About a quarter of them said they would be willing to provide advice regarding the curriculum. And 5% even said that they would be willing to kick in something financially, which I think was a surprise and is pretty good for just being introduced to the program. We also did a survey of students. OUS sent emails out to upper division, science, technology, education, math majors from five Oregon campuses, as well as alumni. They had all received a bachelor's in the last 10 years, and none had a graduate degree at that point. When we asked them if they plan to attend graduate school sometime in the next few years, 75% of them said yes. Alumni, very similar. When asked what kind of graduate degree would you be interested in, the majority there in the red said that they would like to get a master's degree and then pursue a career rather than go on to a doctorate. And then when asked would they be likely to enroll in a master's program with a combination of science coursework, a few business and communication courses, and an internship, the vast majority said yes, we would be very interested in that. These are some of the fields of preference. You can see on the left engineering, environmental science, renewable energy, biotechnology, computer science are of great interest. And when you look at the alumni, it's very similar. Renewable energy, again, is up there. And when we asked students who said they wouldn't be able to attend graduate school, why not? The majority of them said, I can't afford it. And then the next biggest group said it's not required for the career I've chosen. And then finally, 52% said, I don't want to be in school anymore. So these are the partners in our Oregon statewide initiative right now. We like to be inclusive, not exclusive, but we thought that starting through the OUS system would make the most sense. We've had a few workshops. One in 2008 was really to explore interest among the partners in launching into this. And then this past September, we had a 2.5-day workshop in Portland where we made progress to develop a multi-institutional PSM in renewable energy. And the partners there would be Portland State University, Oregon State University, and the Oregon Institute of Technology. We also spent a day working with our partners on best practices for developing PSM programs and how to go about that. I'd like to talk a little bit about Oregon's needs and how these programs might specifically address some of the needs of the state. I think the expanded skilled labor pool is a good thing for the state. We like to create jobs to provide opportunities for the growing population. We want to raise average wages by promoting innovation and increase educational attainment levels. So to expand the skilled labor pool, we're looking at developing new PSM programs. Current PSM programs, computer science, is down at Southern Oregon University, and they're working on developing another program in applied math. Then the renewable energy PSM is something we hope to get launched within the next 2 years. Fisheries and Wildlife Administration will be a completely online PSM open to students in the fall of 2011 is what we're looking at. Marine Resource Management will be accepting students this fall at OSU. And then there's some others that other universities are working on. This is one of our alumni. I wanted to share a little bit about what our alumni think. I think testimonials like that say a lot. This one is a student who graduated from the Environmental Sciences program. And I think when you finish a degree, you have a chance to reflect and look back and see how the degree has benefited you and what it gives you the ability to do. And I think her quote is appropriate. We're interested in raising average wages. This information came from NSF. It's a little dated, 2003, but the median salary 1 to 5 years after the degree is what this graph depicts. And the light purple in the middle of each set for those different scientific disciplines is what the master's earners receive, and you can see that they're very competitive. When you look at the percentage growth in median salaries, you can see that most masters actually earn more than PhDs. And hey, I have two graduate degrees, and the students that I graduate often earn more than I do, so I think that this is right. Increasing the educational level, I highlighted what I really want to show in this table here. Masters and doctorates for profit, primarily it's the masters that are getting jobs. When you look at doctorate degrees, they're primarily ending up in universities. And I don't think that's a surprise. But. So again, the majority of new jobs being created in the non-academic sector, masters requires less time and money than a PhD. 75% of all graduate students in the U.S. were enrolled in master's or graduate certificates, so they're very popular degrees. And a little over half of the graduate students, at least in the fall of 2008, were women. Here's another one of our alum who graduated from OSU's Applied Systematics and Botany. And he says, when you work in any science-based organization, you're not just a scientist. You have to be able to write a business plan and submit a budget for your projects. The PSM program gives you a very valuable combination of skills. Another student graduated from the Applied Physics program, and he did his internship at Biotronic. He's one of the people that then took a full-time job at his internship site. And we find that about 40% of our students end up accepting full-time employment where they did their internship. And I think that says a lot, too. So our graduates stay in the area. About 75% stay in the Pacific Northwest. 60% remain in Oregon. This is from our program. And that compares to about 25% of PhD holders. I mentioned that about internship. 92% of OSU's 38 graduates have found employment in their field in a variety of organizations depending on their field. And finally, I just wanted to say something about the innovative things that Oregon has been doing. We have OTRADI, Signature Research Center, dedicated to providing a unique and previously missing link between Oregon University researchers and biotech or pharmaceutical companies to fuel drug discovery and commercialization in Oregon. We have ONAMI, that is moving nanoscience and microtechnology innovations from basic research through to commercialization. We have Oregon Best that connects the state's businesses with its shared network of university labs to transform green building and renewable energy research into on-the-ground products, services, and jobs for Oregon's green economy. And I would make a pitch to foster innovation in education, and we could perhaps call this OSPSM. And that's to connect the state's employment sectors with universities to foster development of innovative graduate degree programs in STEM that provide that support the state's economic development and workforce needs. Finally, here's a student from our biotechnology program, and I think her quote captures what we're really talking about. She says that the program really enables students to be productive members of the biotech industry, understanding how to turn scientific discoveries into commercial products that can be sold profitably to fund future research. So these students have the education in science combined with the understanding of how it fits into business, and that's very powerful. So my final slide is just on current activities that we're doing to further the statewide initiative. We're kind of creating our identity, a website and brochure. We'd like to develop an internship and jobs bulletin online to connect graduates with industry. We want to create a distance learning consortium to facilitate curriculum sharing among the universities. For example, the 18 credits of professional courses that OSU has is now packaged as an online graduate certificate program that new institutions developing PSMs could just tap into that instead of developing their own. We're also wanting to track our alumni. That way I have more information to share later on. And we want to create the PSM as a degree designation, so it's just not a non-thesis master's, but it's a professional science master's. And with the growing number of degree programs nationally, I think this is a good time. We're creating a statewide PSM advisory board to help us develop new programs, provide us with some guidance. And then we're just fostering workshops and communication among the different institutions to help with that. So that is all that I had. Hope I didn't go over.
You did not. We have a couple of brief minutes left for questions. Thank you so much, Dr. Becker, for coming.
You're welcome.
Today. Are there questions?
It was very thorough.
Representative Thatcher.
Yes, I was wondering if there's any discussion. I noticed there were a lot of slides that talked about the internships that businesses in the private sector would be willing to offer among, you know, businesses, non-business entities as well. But there have been new rules that the Labor Department came out with that kind of, I think, may put a chill on some of that. I just wondered if that weighed into the survey that you took.
Yes, I saw that. I don't think it will put a chill into this. These internships do receive academic credit, which, if I recall what you're talking about, that was one of the criteria. So they're very much tied into that. And the way the internships go about, it's well thought out because it does replace the thesis option. And so we wanted it to be rigorous. So students are required to first create an internship proposal that the internship supervisor and their graduate committee approves. And the criteria for what the student is learning is spelled out in that and the way that they're evaluated. And there's a formal evaluation at the end. And then they have to write a final report, which has both a science component and a business component. And that basically serves as their thesis, which they then present as a defense and then have the oral exam. And so it's very integrated into the educational program. It's not just tacked on.
Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. I think you had mentioned that there are some programs being developed, out-of-state programs, that maybe Oregonians are taking through online means. Is that happening, or maybe I misheard you, or I've heard of that from other contexts?
What do you mean by out-of-state programs?
Well, online entities, you know, some other universities that are, you know, where Oregon students can pursue something like a PSM, you know, while being resident here.
Oh, well, I guess they can do that. That's not part of our initiative. I am aware that OSU is a member of the National or Natural Resources Distance Learning Consortium, and that's where different universities from across the U.S. contribute master's, graduate certificates, and coursework online. And I see a role in that. For example, if we want to create a new PSM program, but we're short one or two classes, but it's available online elsewhere, we could potentially look at it, at incorporating that into the program, and then students can satisfy that requirement that way. But that's the only thing that I'm aware of. Otherwise, we're really looking within Oregon's resources.
Thank you. Yes. Follow up?
I do, yes. Just related to that, and is this an area that the for-profits are getting into?
Absolutely.
Around the country, yeah. Uh-huh. And I guess that's more what I was thinking of in terms of if we have a sense of penetration of those into Oregon to meet this need.
It's very discipline-specific. So, for example, OSU's Applied Biotechnology Program, those students are working for in Invitrogen, Mitosciences, companies like that. And then in environmental sciences, they often work for nonprofits or state and federal government agencies. So it's very discipline-specific where the students end up doing their internships and subsequently finding employment.
Thank you. And Representative Parker gets the last question of this panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This was special. Great info. I didn't know much about this at all, so thanks so much for doing this. A couple of questions. What do you need from us, want from us, and where do the bulk of your applicants come from? Are there people coming directly applying into this program? I can imagine there are also folks who go in, enter a PhD program, decide after a year or two that they're not going to go that route, as a lot of your survey data showed up there, and that they might want to transfer into something like this. So any thoughts on any of those would be welcome.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We don't want to have PSM programs viewed as failed PhDs, however. So usually the majority of students apply to the PSM, and that's their intent from the outset. And we have students come as fresh undergrads that view the PSM as the next move into graduate education. They're drawn to it because of the versatility that they see that it would afford their career because of the additional skills that they get and the appeal of the internship. We also have students that have been out in the workforce for a number of years and are ready to get a graduate education, and it's very appealing to them, the managerial skills, because that's sometimes necessary as they move up the ladder in their career. And in fact, some students have expressed a strong interest just in that professional certificate. And that applies to different professions, for example, veterinarians. I have a veterinary degree. I learned how to be a veterinarian. I had no idea how to run my own practice. So that graduate certificate is very useful for that as well. And so this year, for example, we have received the largest pool of applicants from people that have been in the workforce for a while. And I think it's a sign of the economy. It's a great time to go back and get additional education. So did I answer?
It's all good. I threw a few questions out there. I didn't expect them all to be answered right now, but I'd like to continue the conversation.
Sure.
Okay.
Representative Gelser and Representative Harker, she didn't answer your question about what we're asking for. The answer today is nothing, but don't be surprised if we come back and have some more specific requests for your support.
Thank you both very much for coming today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we have one last panel today, which is a reprise of, I can't remember if you were here last spring or last September. So we have Mr. Sims and his colleagues from Brass Media, and you'll remember he came and talked with us about a financial literacy education program that he had running in a couple of other states. After that meeting here, we got him connected up with Superintendent Castillo and the late Treasurer Westland, and in the months since then, it's my understanding there's been a pretty significant rollout in Oregon high schools, and they've come today to give us an update of on how that's gone, what it's looked like, and I thought it would be nice to end on a cheerful note today.
Whose constituent is this?
Mine.
Oh.
And Senator Morse.
Yes. Okay.
And if you remember how the routine goes, you start by introducing yourself for the record. And
right, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Appreciate you guys having us here. As Representative Denbrow said, if everybody here is the creme de la creme, then I guess we have the rock star team here. That are, the remaining people are employed by me, one of the two. So appreciate you guys taking the time. I'm going to share a real quick update today about the status of the Brass Student Program in Oregon, as well as some things that we had done for Financial Literacy Month, which was this last April. So with that, as we're copying things over, basically what we did over the last month have gone around and visited Oregon high schools as part of the Brass Student Program. And the Brass Student Program is a sponsored initiative by First Tech Credit Union, Oregon Community Credit Union, to get free personal finance resources to high school teachers and students across the state. We actually have some copies of Brass as well as other materials in the back if you'd like to grab them. Our latest cover story is actually about a high school team that's competing in a auto engineering competition and has beat other teams like MIT, so I would invite you guys to take a look at that. Perfect. Excuse me just one moment. So a quick refresher on a few of the things that are part of the student program include copies of Brass Magazine, online access to the Teacher Resource Center that we have, which includes lesson plans, questioning strategies, video content that teachers can share in the classroom about various personal finance topics, a digital edition for students, and a PowerPoint series that teachers can use to basically teach these topics of personal finance, credit, investing, and so forth in their classrooms. So as part of this, we launched the financial, what we call the Money Side of Life tour, as part of Financial Literacy Month, and visited Oregon high schools. Some of the high schools included David Douglas, Gladstone, Canby, Willamette, and Sunset High Schools to multiple teachers and classes. What we did was we brought speakers from all across Oregon that were various entrepreneurship and personal finance experts, people that students could relate to, a lot of people from the Oregon entrepreneurship kind of community, people who are starting electric cars, people who produce socks, people who produce anti-theft security software, a lot of really cool things that students could relate to. And so we went around and visiting classrooms, talking with students about these different topics in, as part of Financial Literacy Month. So the topics we talked about were savings options, personal finance investing, careers, paying for college, entrepreneurship. So here's a couple photos from some of the events. We have here some of the speakers, Laura Edmondson, our Director of Education, Carrie Atkinson, founder of Sakatumi Socks, Portland-based entrepreneur, and myself as well. Here are some of the students using materials in the classroom, including actually one of the cover stories that our students like the most is a group called The Buried Life, who basically are now on MTV, but we featured them before they went on, and they're doing basically 100 things they want to do before they die. So they actually went on Oprah as about 2 weeks ago, so it's kind of an exciting thing. And then one of the other things we also found was that if you give students free things, then it also tends to give better ratings for speaker presentations. I'd invite any members of the committee to try and guess what the shirt says to the right. Any ideas?
Mother.
Well, like the BRS, but
TP Toilet.
Brass, exactly. So if you combine the combine the letters, it's official.
It's a B.
Oh, it is a B. Okay. So much for my vision.
So official brass gear. So with that, what I want to do is to share with you a video that we brought a videographer to every one of the events and created this video for you guys to take a look.
And I'm a co-founder of a company called Journey Gem.
My name is Nate Leibrock.
Joshua Kuhn. I work at the University of Oregon Office of Student Financial Aid and Scholarships, and I'm the assistant director.
My name is Carrie Atkinson. I am the founder of Socketeer. I think the brass events are very good for students. They don't have access to people like us. So brass media brings us all together, and then we can speak to the students, and I think it's interesting for them.
I think that coming in and talking to students in high school about personal finances is very important.
Great, students learned about entrepreneurship. They enjoyed it. They asked lots of questions.
They were inspired, actually, with thinking about possibly being interested in becoming an entrepreneur because of the questions they asked.
A lot of the quiet students who normally don't talk a lot had a lot of great questions. I would definitely recommend that other teachers from all different areas partner with Brass for events and get speakers in and use the Brass magazine to help in their classes.
I saw an article about writing a good resume, and I will use that to my advantage.
They just cover it quite well, and it's so simple to get informed, and it's fun.
Learning about personal finance is really important. It's one of those things that can really make or break you.
Was there ever a point where, like, you thought you should give up?
I think if you look at the state of things, it almost looks like no one knows what they're doing. People are unemployed, people don't have any jobs, and they don't know how they're going to get jobs. People just really need to start being aware as soon as possible.
I liked most about this was how you guys all seemed so interested in us, like how you really wanted to help us with our future.
I want to invest in buying it all.
Some of the questions from students that were seemed to be most common revolved around housing.
I would like to learn more about financial aid.
And the recommendation that I always make to those folks, apply early, apply often, contact your school.
There are a lot of hidden things that you don't really know about unless somebody tells you.
Brass actually talks to you about the stuff that matters.
So there's a quick recap for those of you obviously who weren't able to make it for some of the feedback from students. So thanks for watching that video. I think a couple of the topics that really students consistently had a lot of questions about, obviously jobs being a big one for teenagers and 20-somethings, it's one of the highest unemployed groups out there, paying for college obviously being another. Surprisingly high number of people asking questions related to housing, as I'm sure it's related to families and housing situations people are presently in. And also a consistent interest in investing. And so although I do have some concerns about whether people will be investing in the stock market, considering that their families have
grown up losing money in the stock market, but that's kind of a topic for a different time. So with that, there's a lot of positives, but I wanted to share some of the feedback from some of the students. And to date, with the student program, we've gotten some good media coverage, including the Portland Business Journal. This one particularly talking about a teacher, Morell, who teaches accounting and business law, said he incorporates the magazine in his classes as a way to squeeze more for personal finance education into his students' days. And then Oregon Business said, if Sim's efforts to educate tomorrow's business people pay off, Oregon could have a shiny future full of companies like Brass to look forward to. So we've been fortunate to receive some coverage from there. And today we have over 100 high schools in Oregon that have primary contacts utilizing resources within their classroom and distribute over 60,000 copies in addition to other resources to schools, high schools across Oregon. So we're pretty excited about that. So with that, we would just like to say thank you for your time, and thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee, for allowing us to share this summary.
Are there any questions? Yeah, just keep going. Questions, anybody?
I'm just in shock because we might actually end this committee not just on time, but before our appointment.
Is that why you're pausing for questions?
We would know how to handle that 15 minutes. Representative Parker.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. What limits your ability to spread this out, expose different, more and more students, more and more schools to this?
Representative Harker, one of the challenges that we have right now is just simply getting access to the teachers within the different schools. And so as every school has different types of teachers, some being business educators, some being personal finance, some teaching entrepreneurship, trying to locate those teachers within each school and within each district is a large challenge for us. So in trying to forge new relationships with people, whether that be at the principal, the mm-hmm. high school, or even the superintendent level, is something that we're continuing to try and pursue.
I can add to that, too, Chair Gelser and Representative Parker. My name is Laura Edmonston. I'm the Director of Education for the Brass Student Program. One of the things that we've done to sort of expand the reach, a tactic that we've used, is going into different departments that, say, for instance, a school may have dropped their business education program, but we still feel, of course, that this is a really important topic for students to learn. So going into, say, the social studies department, or some other classes that might be applicable. So really, it's just kind of expanding our target audience and, like Brian said, reaching those teachers all over the school and really impressing upon teachers and principals that whether a business education class is offered in your school or not, this is a topic that is important to all students.
Thank you. Representative Parker, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Do you approach school district level conversations?
Chair Gelser, Representative Parker, we at times we do. Primarily, we go with the school administration and start our conversation at that level. Mm-hmm. But we're definitely open to going to the district level.
Well, are you finding it more productive to go directly to the schools rather than to the district level, or just have not had that much option to get to the districts?
Not had that much the option ladder. To get to the districts.
Yes. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right, Representative Springer.
Thank you. Can we help you do that?
Chair Gelser and Representative Springer, yes, we will take any help we can get in that respect.
Okay.
And our contact information is in the back of the, it's all over the magazine, of course, but in the, you should have received a packet about the tour, and in the back, there's contact information for both Brian and myself.
And Representative Roblin.
I just want to say, I think it's absolutely, it's finding the teacher if you really want the material to be used, because I think it's nice to get the district and whatever, but when you make the relationship with the teacher, that's when it actually gets used. And if you don't, they can send all the stuff to the place and they'll sit in boxes. And it's very frustrating as a principal at one time to know there's a great programs, but until you can get that one teacher who really decided, oh, this is really important, I need to do it, it's really hard. You mandate something, it doesn't work very well. We found that a few times here. But if you can find that teacher, if you can get that connection somehow. So again, I will try to do whatever I can do in my communities to talk to teachers to get them to talk to you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for coming. Committee, I neglected to do something very important at the beginning. You probably know that Dana has left us for the Senate. And we will miss her, but the
upside is that Cheyenne Ross has come to join us, and I've had the great fortune of working with Cheyenne in Representative Roblin's committee in Rule, so it felt very natural to come in today, but Cheyenne will be with us through the rest of the interim supporting our work. One of the important pieces of that work is to remember the new rules that we adopted in February for bill introduction. So for our interim committee, any committee bill requests that we need to make have to be made before September 27th, which means we have one more committee before that happens. So if you have legislation, ideas, concerns that you are interested in having drafted as a committee bill, the sooner you can be communicating with Cheyenne and me about that would be better. And it can help us make sure that we get it done and get it back.
So if you have any bills that you want to just talk to your
And with that, anything else for the good of the order? No, thank you all very much for a good day, and thank you again for coming. And the House Committee on Education is adjourned.